Delaney Nard. Thank you so much for the morning show theme song on this February 29th. It's a Monday leap day, February, of course, the 29th day every 4 years. Most 4 year cycles we have, but not always. And it is the last day, by the way, of Black History Month. I will play the monologue from the Academy Awards last night, Chris Rock taking on racism in Hollywood. So I think that's a fitting coda to Black History Month. We also have thought wrestler Danny Cardwell joining us at 7 Pacific, 10 East Coast time. And I'll certainly go over the situation with the primary races in both parties, with, as is always the case with me, as you know, very significant focus on the Democrats, because the Republicans aren't interesting to me. They're loathsome. They're frightening. They're bad. They're evil. But they're not really interesting in the sense that none of them stand out to me as somebody that I would even, you know, consider on a bad day voting for. And they're really not that different from each other either. I've got a video with audio that I think really proves that, really demonstrates that. So we'll get to that at some point. I think we might as well start with, and why not, the Academy Awards last night. Now, I didn't watch them. I don't watch these shows. You know, I play stuff for you. I do the research. I'll tell you what, before maybe we'll get there in a little bit. I do want to respond to what Press was saying at the end of his show about South Carolina. I've been down. Look, I've been down since the Nevada caucuses, and Bernie lost that 5.5 to 6 points. A lot of people said, Clifton Brown said, some of the media said that was actually a pretty good result for him, that he was not expected to do so well. Even to come within six, that because of the demographic, heavily Latino, for him to come within six was pretty impressive. The problem, as Clifton said, was that the setup, the particular order of the primaries really hurts him going forward with South Carolina and then Super Tuesday. And Bernie lost, you know, momentum. There's no question. Even if you can try to convince somebody that a loss by 5.5 to 6 points ain't bad. In fact, some would argue, including, well, Brown, but also Nate Silver said that Sanders outperformed expectations in Nevada. I don't buy it. I mean, I just totally don't. You know, he was tied with 4 or 5 days before, according to one poll. A number of pundits thought he would win, including the guru of Nevada, John Ralston. He came, well behind, came in well behind Clinton. And the blowout in South Carolina, I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm always a pessimist. You know, for me, optimism means I think my guy's going to win, my guy in this election cycle, obviously, being Bernie Sanders. So I'm always a pessimist, period. For me, it's not over until it really, really, really is over. But I looked at the results in Nevada, and I looked at what was coming down the road last week in South Carolina. I just said that this just ain't going to be good. This does not look good. This isn't looking good. And it wasn't. It did not look good at all. In fact, Nate Silver said that the late polls in South Carolina showed a real break for Hillary Clinton, including one that showed her winning by 38%, which would be what, about 65, if I do the math right. 38% would be somewhere around 65, 27, maybe 70, 32. That would be too much, right? So 68, 30, something like that. 68, 30. And he said he didn't buy that. He didn't think it would be that big a blowout. 74, 26. 74, 26. She won every demo, pretty big. And I was reading, except for voters under 30, 29 to the least likely to vote. Bill Press said before my show, just before I came on the air, that, you know, hey, Bernie's going to fight another day. Yeah, it wasn't good. He admitted it. He said, you know, during Meet the Press, we lost badly, especially among older African-American voters. But he saw some silver linings in that cloud. Press starts talking about how Bernie's going to win five, could win up to five, and say he would, could win up to five primaries coming, you know, up tomorrow, Super Tuesday. And he listed, what, Massachusetts, Colorado, Minnesota, and I can't remember the other two. I'll tell you what, I don't see it happening. Oklahoma? Did he say Oklahoma? Those states are not trending towards Bernie. I mean, I hate to burst anybody's bubble. And I remember what my friend Doug DV said, hey, I'm not listening to you anymore. It's about as much fun as a funeral. So you may think that, and that's fine. You don't have to think this is fun at all. I'm just here telling you the way I see it. Lots of times I'm wrong. Lots of times I'm wrong. So I could be completely off base here. But I don't see any state right now on Super Tuesday where Bernie is leading, except obviously Vermont. He is now seeing his not tied in Massachusetts. He's seeing that slip away. Friday, a poll showed him down by 5, WBUR. And then today, a poll was released. No, yesterday. Sorry, yesterday. A poll was released showing him down 8 to Clinton. It's just not going well. I don't know. Colorado has not been polled. Minnesota, there haven't been polls. Those are caucus states. But we saw in a caucus state, Nevada, where there was a lot of excitement for Sanders building up. And it went for Clinton. She's got the organization. She's got the money. She's got the establishment behind her. And I had hoped that would not be enough to carry a very seriously flawed, regressive candidate. Let's face it. She's not progressive. She's regressive. I thought the major problems she should be having, given her tight connection to Wall Street, the Goldman Sachs speeches, the hawkish record, that's never changed. She's always been a war hawk. She still is. You know, as late as October of last year, calling for no-fly zone, she's never backed off of that. She's moved to the left on some issues. She's basically, you know, tried to be the progressive that Bernie Sanders really is on economic issues. I thought people would see through that. The phony embrace of President Obama, I didn't think people were going to buy it. I mean, the championing, remember, of the 1994 crime bill, and then the claim, well, Sanders voted for it, as though that was supposed to excuse her campaigning on getting tough on crime, locking people up. Sanders said, hey, I don't want to do that. We shouldn't be doing that. That is a big mistake. I'll support this bill because of the funding for violence against women, you know, to target violence against women, but I don't want to lock people up. I don't believe in private prisons. I just couldn't imagine that people would rush for Hillary Clinton. You know, I figure she might win. I'm not saying she wasn't still the front runner even after the blowout in New Hampshire, but I thought it was going to really go the distance, perhaps. I hoped that. And kind of my hopes were dashed on the casinos and the casinos of Las Vegas and then obviously in South Carolina. Now, who knows? Tomorrow could be a complete 180. We could see things change. I'd be shocked. I'd be amazed. She's got double-digit leads in big, important states. In Virginia, 17-point lead. I don't see how Bernie turns this sucker around. And that means we'll be the losers. Without question, we're going to be the loser. The people will lose. It's so sad. It's so sad. I want strategy. What's the answer, folks? What's the answer? 844-4-HELL-G. 844-367-4254. All of this life.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Hundreds of Los Angeles area janitors are demanding an end to hazardous working conditions, wage theft, and sexual assault. Labor leaders say hundreds and perhaps thousands of the hardest working people in the city suffer abuses of the worst kind in silence. Ernesto Arce has more from Los Angeles.
A few hundred janitors marched through the business district in downtown Los Angeles to demand respect, ya basta, enough, of risky work conditions. Lydia has cleaned her Woodland Hills office building for 27 years. She says sexual harassment, including assault, is a routine hazard that janitors face while working late night hours, sometimes in the presence of only a senior male manager or a lone office employee.
We do the hard work. And then some companies that abuse the janitors, we want the respect. Because it's many years, different manners we are there abuse us. We are women working hard. You know, it's most of women, and we want respect.
United Service Workers West organizers point out that a recent PBS special, Rape on the Night Shift, exposed the epidemic of sexual assault that victimizes cleaning staff across the country. Nowhere is that more painfully evident than in the offices and hotel rooms in downtown LA's business district, where thousands of janitors work graveyard shifts. United Service Workers West says its largely immigrant workforce is calling for respect, especially as the presidential campaign has offered harsh words for immigrants. For Workers Independent News, Ernesto Arce, Los Angeles.
Black U.S. workers are falling behind white workers in retirement equality, the Economic Policy Institute says. As private employers replaced defined benefit pensions with 401ks, it has widened the retirement gap between black and white. EPI found that only 47% of black workers had a retirement plan at work in 2014 versus 53% of whites. EPI says black workers are both less likely to be offered a retirement plan and to opt into a voluntary plan, although whether or not they're offered a plan in the first place is the larger factor. In 2013, white families had nearly five times as much wealth in retirement accounts as their black counterparts, nearly $100,000 more in retirement savings.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening
as a veteran to
Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Aloha. I'm Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. As a veteran of two Middle East deployments, I know firsthand the cost of war. I know how important it is that our Commander-in-Chief has the sound judgment required to know when to use America's military power and when not to use that power. As a Vice Chair of the DNC, I'm required to stay neutral in Democratic primaries, but I cannot remain neutral any longer. The stakes are just too high. That's why today I'm endorsing Senator Bernie Sanders to be our next President and Commander-in-Chief of the United States. We need a Commander-in-Chief who has foresight, who exercises good judgment, and who understands the need for a robust foreign policy which defends the safety and security of the American people, and who will not waste precious lives and money on interventionist wars of regime change. Such counterproductive wars undermine our national security and economic prosperity. As these elections continue across the country, the American people are faced with a very clear choice. We can elect a president who will lead us into more interventionist wars of regime change, or we can elect a president who will usher in a new era of peace and prosperity. It's with this clear choice in mind that I'm resigning as vice chair of the DNC so that I can strongly support Bernie Sanders as the Democratic nominee for president of the United States. And now I ask you, stand with me and support Bernie Sanders.
Very powerful ad there, Tulsi Gabbard, a Congresswoman from Hawaii, who was, as she tells you, in that spot that she recorded explaining why she left the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and why she is endorsing Bernie Sanders. Just laying it all out there. And her major focus as a veteran is foreign affairs. I think this was an area where Bernie really had an opportunity. He should have gone after Clinton a lot more aggressively, a lot harder than he did. Tulsi Gabbard obviously doesn't think it's over yet. She resigned from the DNC. She resigned from the Debbie Wasserman Schultz organization, which she has said in the past clearly is and wrongly is favoring Clinton when it is supposed to remain neutral. And Gabbard, as a veteran, says, hey, Bernie is so much better on foreign policy. I cannot, in good conscience, stay out of this race. He is not going to get us involved in destructive wars of regime change. There's a very, very impressive article, and it's a little late. Thank you very much, New York Times. That was published yesterday, Hillary Clinton's Legacy in Libya. I guess it was put up on the website on Saturday. It does say Feb 28, but I think I saw this maybe Saturday. A little late, though, a day late and a dollar short about how destructive that legacy in Libya is. I'll play the video for you the New York Times puts out there. It's devastating. It's devastating. Now, I'm a little bit of a Johnny-come-lately to this. I have in the past defended the intervention, at least when it came to the bombing of the road to Benghazi. The goal then was, or at least the ostensible goal, the enunciated goal by the U.S. and NATO forces, led by the U.S., was to prevent a massacre in East Libya where there were rebels who had challenged the authority of Gaddafi, the colonel who was the dictator at that point. And I said, hey, listen, we can't have killing. I mean, we just can't have a government killing its own people. Turns out, a number of people are saying, even at the time, were saying this is overstated. He has not killed nearly as many rebels. There were reports that Gaddafi had already killed 10,000 people. He was going to go house to house and kill hundreds of thousands more. And at that time, credible sources were saying this is not true. In 2011, in March, they were saying this is not true. But even still, I accepted the rationale to bomb that road to Benghazi. The problem was the bombing continued and continued and continued long after the ability of the Libyan army to take control of East Libya, and presumably if its goal was to kill and massacre rebels, it no longer had that ability. And we kept bombing along with NATO, along with France. And the result was Gaddafi was killed. The hopes for some kind of continuing Arab Spring failed completely, and the country is a failed state. It's basically a vacuum. It's a nihilist paradise. Hillary Clinton, more than anyone else in the Obama administration, championed that action. She championed that intervention. She championed regime change in Libya. She clearly learned nothing from the disastrous regime change in Iraq. And now she's calling for a no-fly zone over Syria. Is there any reason to believe she would not embroil us in another war in the Middle East if she became president? She was endorsed by prominent neocon Robert Kagan, one of the architects of the Iraq War, for which she voted. Clinton hired Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, also a neocon, somebody who, after Clinton left the State Department, Nuland was her spokesperson at State. After Clinton left the State Department, Nuland got herself very closely involved in Ukraine. And there's some, you know, finger pointing and blame shifting going around, people trying to claim, and it seems with justification, although without proof, that Nuland was behind the regime change in Ukraine, which also destabilized the region to a degree, that in fact that regime change was accomplished with the help of ultra-right-wing nationalists and neo-Nazi skinheads in Ukraine, and that the blame that I have leveled against Putin for refusing to stay out of Ukraine is in fact partly due to the fact, it's a scary group of people there in Ukraine. That was Victoria Nuland's, Hillary's choice at State Department. So she surrounds herself with neocons, with people who believe in regime change, and she herself has supported regime change on more than one occasion. It's hard, even when the interests of the United States were clearly not, our security was not at risk. I don't know how people can say she's not a neocon. This is an argument I've been getting into at the DAG blog, where I post. I don't know how you can say she's not a neocon. She believes in a muscular use of American foreign policy, up to and including regime change in cases where a dictator, tyrant, leader, whatever you want to call him, is not posing a risk to our interests. And in fact, taking him out probably will hurt our interests, as it certainly did in Iraq, as it certainly did in Libya with Gaddafi, as it did in Iraq with Hussein, Saddam Hussein. So I don't know how she's not a neocon. I'm getting a lot of crap from people who say, well, she's not a true neocon. I'm trying to understand then what is a neocon, if not somebody who believes that the U.S. foreign policy should take into account in every situation or most situations the possibility of taking out leaderships, taking out regimes, governments, and seeing what will happen. That's, to me, the essence of a neocon. And if you want to say, well, you're forgetting about the neo part, well, yeah, it's a new conservative idea, which the old one often was isolationism, or we only react when we are directly threatened, when we're attacked. So this is a new aggressive kind of foreign policy. Moreover, it's she was formerly, I guess, a bit of a dove at one point. She protested against the Vietnam War. So I don't know how anyone can say she's not a neocon. She's as neocon as they come. We'll talk more about it. I got Carl calling in. We got a break. We'll take Carl out of the break. Don't forget, Thought Wrestler Danny Cardwell on at 10 East Coast, 7 Pacific. But I was hoping, you know, that we would see maybe Bernie could rise from the ashes of Nevada. That's not going to happen. We will also get to Republicans. They are far worse than Clinton.
This is Scientific American's 60-Second Science. I'm Lee Billings. You got a minute? Radio waves are invisible to our eyes. But if you could see them, the sky would dance with random tiny flashes. Thousands of what are called fast radio bursts are estimated to occur every day. And though each pinprick flash lasts only a thousandth of a second, they represent a faraway source briefly shining a billion or more times brighter than our sun. Fast radio bursts have been known for nearly a decade, but scientists have struggled to determine exactly where they come from, and they'd like to know, because finding their origins would help astronomers use the bursts as probes to map the history and structure of the universe in unprecedented detail. Now, researchers have found the source of one particular burst. They used radio telescopes in Australia and the giant Subaru optical telescope in Hawaii to trace a burst observed last April. And they determined it came from an old elliptical galaxy full of exhausted, dying suns some 6 billion light-years away. The findings are in the journal Nature. Identifying the source galaxy provides crucial clues. For one thing, such a galaxy is short on some of the objects expected to cause bursts, such as supernovae or rapidly spinning and flaring pulsars, suggesting this burst came from something else. And although the burst in question lasted only milliseconds, astronomers were able to witness its faint, fading radio afterglow for about 6 days. That's the sort of afterglow expected from a colliding pair of ancient neutron stars, which would be a relatively common occurrence among an elliptical galaxy's geriatric suns. Even though this particular burst has probably been explained, many mysteries remain. Not all bursts seem to come from the same cosmic source. Fortunately, most possible burst sources could be distinguished by the gravitational waves they emit, like those recently seen by the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. That means researchers may soon be searching the skies for both radio and gravitational waves from these bursts to help draw an ever more detailed map of the cosmos. Thanks for the minute. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Lee Billings.
I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to that. I didn't really understand what he was talking about. Dow is down 3 points to 16,640. NASDAQ flat at this moment at 4590. S&P 500 down 1 in 1948. Gold is up $10 an ounce at 1229. Oil also up 43 cents a barrel. Currently priced at 33.21. I was going to continue and play a little bit more clips for you. This was specifically about Hillary Clinton's legacy in Libya, but my good friend Carl's on the line. So instead, I'm going to play this clip for him and for you. This is from, the 25th. This is Thursday, the GOP debate Thursday, and just some highlights for you, Carl and listeners.
This guy's a choke artist, and this guy's a liar.
20 insults.
You don't know anything about business.
Well, I don't know anything about bankrupting four companies.
Where was Donald? He was firing Dennis Rodman on Celebrity Apprentice.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
If he builds the wall the way he built Trump Towers, he'll be using illegal immigrant labor to do it.
He lied. 100%.
If he hadn't inherited $200 million, you know where Donald
Trump would be
right now?
No.
Selling watches in Manhattan.
This is another area on which Donald agrees with Hillary Clinton.
I think Bush did a hell of a bad job.
First of all, very few people listen to your radio show. That's the good news.
A lot of these positions that he's now taking are new to him.
When you say crazy zealot, are you talking about you?
You may not be aware of this, Donald, because you don't follow this stuff very closely.
Yeah, I know you're embarrassed, but keep fighting, keep swinging, men. Swing for the fences.
I watched him melt down, and I'll tell you, it was one of the saddest things I've ever seen.
We had a lot of fun up here tonight, I have to tell you. Thank you for the book.
Donald, relax.
Go ahead. I'm relaxed. You're the basket case.
All right, your three favorite, I can't even say Americans, right? Because one of them's a Canadian. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Yeah. I'm doing great. Before I get to the clown show, I have to push back just a little bit on you. It's amazing that I couldn't believe that you're using the Republican trick of guilt by association, and in a weird roundabout way, you're trying to blame Hillary Clinton for what's happening in Ukraine. That's ridiculous.
I'm not trying to blame her. If that's how it came across, then I misunderstood or misspoke. I don't blame her for what happens in Ukraine.
Vladimir Putin, the gangster of Russia, and what's going on with Ukraine.
Her former spokesperson.
She's a damn candidate without having to tear down another person.
Look at what's going on over there. That's not fair.
Look at what's going on in the report. It's not fair. You're trying to play the guilt by association. The Republicans did the same damn thing to Barack Obama with Saul Alinsky, and they're still doing it right now.
Wait, with what? Oh, Saul Alinsky?
He piled around with terrorists.
No,
with one of
it's a little different. It's not the same.
Them.
It's not the same. First of all, it isn't.
It's garbage. It's garbage.
All right. All right. Well, okay. Go ahead. Okay. Whatever. I'm not going to argue with you. Go ahead.
Right. Okay. And let's play a little game here. Let's get where our focus need to be on the racist Republican Party. Let's play a little game here. You're an interviewer, and I've heard your interview. You do very, very good interviews. Ask me a question, Carl. Do you accept or renounce the support of David?
How about if I do an interview you the way I would, as you're an expert on the Democratic Party, because I think this would be sort of fun, and you're an expert as a political analyst. So, do you view Trump's initial apparent confusion when asked about the endorsement he received from former Klansman David Duke? How do you react to that?
I'm going to tell you exactly how I react to it. See, in the past, and you have to have paid attention to what's been going on with the Republican Party in the past. See, in the past, you used to be able to use the dog whistle, and that answer that he gave would have been okay. But now the racists within the party, they want you to be blunt. They don't want you to dance around. So it's hard for him to dance around that question like he did and satisfy his base. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know. I think no one wants to renounce endorsements. This is a really bad guy, David Duke. And with his...
No. The answer, by the way, to my rhetorical question, no. I do not accept his. I don't accept him or the Klan's endorsement. This jackass right here said on national television and feigned ignorance about David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan. He act like he didn't know what kind of organization you wouldn't want me to. You wouldn't want organizations that endorse you that you know nothing about. I don't know nothing about those organizations. The Klan, the probably one of the longest running terrorist groups in the world. The Klan, probably one of the first domestic terrorist groups other than the forming of the United States when we were fighting the Crown. It has to be the longest running terrorist group within the United States. And he acts like he didn't know who they were. And this is what the Republican Party is about to nominate. We need to, instead of trying to dig up what's going on with Hillary Clinton and really trying to reach for things because you are against her, we need to be pointing out them with four fingers and a thumb and showing exactly what that party's about. Because there's no way in the world under normal circumstances he should still be a viable candidate for president. He should be giving his I'm dropping out speech today behind yesterday. But he's not, because that's what they are. And I guarantee you his numbers will go up.
Well, his numbers are up. I mean, he's at 49% right now, and number two is Rubio with 15%. He's going to be the nominee. Let me play this. This is
not going to hurt him at all. Not going to hurt him at all. What he did yesterday would not hurt him at all. He pulled out the old dog whistle, brushed it off, and blew it loud and clear to the racists in the Republican Party. I'm with you.
Yeah, I don't. Let me play it for you. I don't want to be in a position to defend it. I'm not going to defend Trump. Here's the audio.
Racism.
No, I watched it. You don't have to.
I know, but I want to play it for listeners too.
Yeah, for listeners. Okay.
Unequivocally, the racism of former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke, who recently said that voting against you at this point would be treason to your heritage. Will you unequivocally condemn David Duke and say that you don't want his vote or that of other white supremacists in this election?
Well, just so you understand, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? I don't know anything about what you're even talking about with white supremacy or white supremacists. So I don't know. I mean
that's
know
obviously
if,
unbelievable. He's going to know. He's got to know
exactly.
Who the Klan is and Duke. He might not have known about the endorsement. I'll give him that. It's possible. I don't know when.
No, he did know about it.
How did he know?
A reporter asked him about it Friday on videotape. Saturday when he pulled out Chris Christie, that same press conference when he had Chris Christie out with him, telling everybody that he's gonna endorse me. A reporter asked him that question. He did know about the endorsement. Don't give this man the benefit of the doubt. There's no benefit for this man.
And by the way, I'm not giving him any benefits of the doubt. That is a very bad, fact for Trump. That makes Trump look especially bad because he tried to excuse his failure to renounce Duke during that interview, which was yesterday, by saying he didn't hear the question clearly. And then he did say that's what CNN is reporting.
I watched it when it happened live on State of the Union yesterday morning. And you should have seen Jake Tapper is a Republican. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or about it. He's in the tank for the Republican Party. He's trying to downplay Bernie, and he's trying to distort Hillary Clinton as much as he possibly can. You should have seen his face. Listening to it does no justice. You need to see the tape of a late 40-year-old man in his mid to late 40s giving an interview to a man that's damn near in his 70s, if he's not in his 70s, and the look on his face when this man act like he didn't know what and who the Klan was all about. And he didn't know what and who David Duke was all about. It was a shock. It was the face of a man that knew that what happened yesterday are commercials that write themselves in the general election against the Republican Party. It was stunned. He looked bewildered, like, are you freaking kidding me?
All right, well, we'll see. I'm certainly not defending Trump in any way. I refuse to do that. I don't know that I see this as quite as awful as you do, but on the other hand, you're African American. I'm not, Carl, so
you know,
I take.
I am, when a man that old in our racist ass country, in the history of our country, he didn't. You gonna say you didn't see quite the way I saw it? Do you need to be black to see what I saw?
It's really bad, Carl. You know what? I take that back. It's awful. It's awful. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have. I was wrong. You're right. It is awful. I don't know where to go with this. It was an awful thing that he did.
I take that back, Carl.
I shouldn't have said that, and I was wrong to say it. It was awful what Trump did. But go ahead.
I tell you what, Hal. I've been an American all my life. I'm 45 years old. I've lived in the South, I've lived in the deep, deep South, and I've lived in the North. There's no more racist and segregated city than my city, Chicago, Illinois. And that's a fact. I've seen half my other family come from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Carl, can I just interrupt you for a sec? I got Douglas calling, so let me just get Douglas on. I'll have him respond to you in a second, but let me just get your final point. So you're saying you lived in Chicago, that's the most segregated city in America. Go ahead.
Yeah. I've seen racism. I've looked at it. I've walked it. I know what it looks like. I know what it smells like. I know it when I see it. I know the dog whistle when I see and hear it. I just know it. And the Republican Party is that. For years, liberals, progressive, Democrats, whatever the label you want to put up, they've all, in particular white liberals, have always shied away from, they've always wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt. They are what they are. I mean, it just is. If I'm wearing a blue shirt, you can't tell me that shirt is green or black or yellow. It is a blue shirt. And this is what the Republican Party is. And part of my frustration with you this morning is that I've been dealing with this with white liberals forever. It's almost like they're afraid to call them out for what they are.
All right, hold on. Let me get. I want to get Douglas in because he can be sort of a shield for me, or maybe not. Go ahead, Douglas. You're on with Carl and Hal.
Well, you got to listen to. I'm going to use information on Gloria Nuland.
Victoria Nuland.
Her relationship.
All right, you want to go back to that? Do you want to talk about Trump at all, or no? You don't want to talk about Trump.
No, someone asked that. Nobody that's running, I think, consciously would say, "Oh yeah, I like the support of the KKK and David Duke." I mean, when you can see the guy was being asked this question, you can see Trump didn't know who. Obviously, we know who the KKK is, but they specifically were saying David Duke, and you know, it's one of those things. They ask you a question, you don't understand it, so you ask them to repeat it a couple of times, and it's a non-issue. Donald Trump's not going to win a national election, but that's okay. One of the things that you got to hear some of these people slip in when they read the front newspapers and they have these little catchphrases that's coming from our equivalent to Pop Pravda. When Carl mentioned that Vladimir Putin's a gangster, that gangster. Where does that come from? I mean, how does Vladimir Putin become the gangster, the president and leader of Russia? Becomes a
gangster.
Are
you defending Vladimir Putin, Douglas? Are you absolutely kidding me?
I don't want this to devolve.
I'll tell you what. Listen, do me a favor. I'll tell you what.
I'm going to let Carl go because you got a radio show. Let it be a radio show.
Well, but if they're going to yell, you're not going to respond.
I'm not going to yell. Hey, Carl, tell me why Vladimir Putin is a gangster, but the United States government isn't.
But you're going to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt.
I have
you're
going to
defend Vladimir Putin. You're going to defend Vladimir Putin while giving Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt that he didn't hear the question. Are you absolutely kidding me? That's still worse than I thought.
All right. I'm gonna let Carl go. Thanks for the call, no. Carl. I'll talk to you. No, it's all right because it's not gonna. You know why, Douglas? Because everyone's talking past each other, and it's not worth it. Your point is, it's just not worth having it. I will get to Putin in a second.
My point is, let him answer why Vladimir Putin is a gangster.
Well, he wasn't going to answer. He said, "Are you defending him?" He wasn't. He's just going to say he's not going to answer him. I guess he said, "Well,
because
it's not a conversation where we're learning from each other," and I find that very frustrating. I just want to say something about the situation with Trump. Look, it's awful that Trump didn't just, you know, I don't even know what he was supposed to say at that point. I don't think we see. If I say anything that isn't totally negative against Trump, I'm going to get totally slammed. On the other hand, I mean, he has – well, let me play this and see if this satisfies anybody. Of course, my video thing doesn't.
I'm not defending Trump, so you don't have to play it at all.
I'm not defending Trump. I just – I don't know if this is the worst – like you said, it's a non-issue.
What I'm saying, when you get these – listen to me. I can tell you where that whole Vladimir Putin is a gangster. But yet, let me tell you something. We have 812 military bases in 138 countries. We have over 800 military bases in 138 different countries. We have attacked Panama in the middle of the night and arrested the president on a drug charge. We have forced the plane of the Bolivian president. Moro in another country so we can see if David Assange was on the plane, forced to, I mean, that's unheard of. No country has ever done that before. We have attacked Iraq. We've attacked Syria and supported arms and military for Syria. We have attacked Libya on the most scantily of reasons that somehow we're the world's police. What we've done in South America, listen, let me tell you something. If anyone knows this, that Russia has more right to Crimea than we have to the islands off of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. How do you justify that? Enforcing and putting the prisoners there. When you see these clowns that read the front page of the paper and all of a sudden Vladimir Putin becomes a gangster, but yet you sit in the country that is attacking and literally set the Middle East on fire. The whole Middle East is on edge and on fire because of the United States. But yet they can say Vladimir Putin is a gangster. And the only way they could – I mean, the United States overthrew a democratically elected country and a president in Ukraine. And Gloria Nuland headed that. And I'm going to send you a clip that she admits that we spent $5 million in overthrowing the government, the democratically elected government in the Ukraine. We spent $5 billion. She spoke at a Chevron conference. I mean, this stuff is there for people to read and see. The U.S. spent $5 billion in overthrowing the democratically elected government of the Ukraine. And now the government, look at Ukraine is now.
You know what I just don't get? What I don't get is when people start arguing that Clinton isn't a neocon. I mean, look who she surrounds herself with. Look at the position she's taken when she's been in a position to have influence. Douglas, she's consistently supported regime change. And that is, if anything, the definition of a neocon. I mean, if you look back at when Kissinger, who she says is her good friend, you know, I want to say this. It's awful, the whole situation. I probably shouldn't even go there. But, you know, when people get all angry at Trump because of his failure to answer the Duke question correctly, I get that. But then how come people aren't equally incensed that Hillary Clinton calls Henry Kissinger her friend? I mean, look at what that guy did. I think there's a double standard there.
The only thing that started me with you and a caller was the fact that it's association. What are you going to do, guilt with association? Is that what you're doing? But yet you sit there and say, hey, I'm friends with Henry Kissinger. Oh, I voted to overthrow.
Somebody I consult with. He's somebody she consults with.
Look at his history. I mean, and so as long as you have these relationships, our position in the United States will never change. I mean, Vietnam. I mean, and I'm a little partial. I mean, my view of Vietnam, because I go there on, I was going there on a super regular basis. Now it's diminished a bit. And I've seen the results. You know, I've seen the results of the drinking water of Agent Orange and its effect on, still an effect to the, you know, the people in Vietnam. I've seen, the numbers of 3 million people estimated dying in Vietnam. I mean, for what? You know, 50,000 soldiers in Vietnam. So far for Iraq, 30. I mean, we've got 5,500 people, soldiers, U.S. soldiers, dead because of Iraq and Afghanistan. I went into a summer school in a city of 5,000 people. I mean, of a college, of a city that was 5,000 people in southern Utah. I know what 5,000 people is. And so when you look at the American soldiers that have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's 5,000, a little over 5,000 right now. That's literally a city of people that I lived in for 6 months. So I know what 5,000 is. One of the things I'd ask, it just annoys the hell out of me that people can sit there and read the front pages of the paper, and I'm not defending Vladimir Putin at all. I don't know. But you can see one day, all of a sudden, the front times
well,
of the New York Times and the Washington Post.
It's somewhat disingenuous at best to say how evil they are when we don't talk about what we've done.
Right. And I think one of the key words that you said is the positions that someone's taken. And Hillary Clinton has continuously and consistently taken these crazy positions, even if to the point
of... But let me ask you this question, and then I got to let you go. But what about Carl's response is... Okay. That, all right, if you want to go after Clinton and blame her for this and that, fine. But the real problem is the Republicans, and you shouldn't be undermining Clinton when you got a guy like Trump who doesn't even, immediately disavow the support he supposedly is getting from David Duke.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Well, he said something racist. You don't see that they're racist? And it has nothing to do with it. I mean, it's so... beneath to sit there and say, well, somebody didn't defend David Duke or the KKK. By me supporting Bernie, I'm beyond the Hillary Clintons and the Donald Trumps. I mean, we're even thinking even better than that, that we could and always could have been better. And to accept the status quo of regime change and attacking other countries and setting up military bases and using economic hitmen, for the others. So when we don't military invade them, we use the economic hit system, and we'll bring them down and bring them, listening under our thumb economically, which we've done in South America. And so it has nothing to do with you're defending Vladimir Putin. Who's defending him? I'm just saying if you're going to point at Vladimir Putin, then take a look at where we are, what we're doing. How many countries are Russia actively in right now? I mean, in wars. I mean, literally wars. I mean, this is crazy what we're doing, and it's I don't think it's to our future benefit. It's the downfall of an empire. So what they start screaming, instead of answering a question, they start screaming, you're defending. Wait, I just asked you a question. You can't answer the question?
Well, this is what Carl is saying. Carl is saying that when he, sort of the opposite of you, Carl is saying, hey, just because he calls Putin a gangster doesn't mean he's not saying there aren't other gangsters out there. Because you basically said to him, well, how can you call – you said, well, why do you call him a gangster? But then you said you're not defending Putin. You're just pointing out all the bad things that Victoria Nuland has done, which basically was, again, another regime that was changed, and the result has been, really catastrophic. So Carl's saying back at you, well, hey – maybe I call Putin a gangster, but I'm not defending Nuland. That's his response.
No, Carl's saying you're defending because you say, why do you call Putin a gangster? He goes back to, you defend Donald Trump? And the KKK,
I don't think he said that. I didn't hear that. I think what his point was that whatever bad things you and I say about Clinton, they pale in comparison to Trump, who doesn't even immediately, although he did, he did say today he disavows Duke. He did say that. And, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe it's, again, I hate the KKK. This is evil. They're terrorists. They're murderers. They're as bad as, they're Nazis. They're as bad as anybody. I'm not defending them. I want to be very clear. I don't know how far Trump is supposed to go in that situation with that interview. He says he didn't hear it correctly. He wasn't sure who David Duke was. Duke says Duke knew him. Who knows?
One of the things is, and I'll get the last, I'll say it and let you move forward, is the structure that the Republican structure has decided to turn all guns on and against Donald Trump, which I don't care. I don't care that the Republican Party can kill themselves. But I'm not going to be stupid and wake up and pick up the newspaper and everything that Donald Trump says now has to take on the super negative tone. So what I do is I scan all the electronic newspapers, and you can see the consistency of the Republican structure going after Donald Trump, which is okay. I don't care, but I consciously can see it, how anything he says and anything he does is going to be the negative narrative in the lead all day long from now on, because they're scared, they're hurting, because he actually is, you know, he's going to win the Republican nomination. I mean, and that's what I'm looking at. And so when you look at the front news of the newspapers and someone says, you know, Putin's a gangster, then you look up gangster Putin and see where it came from, how it all started, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post. But they never sit there and go, Obama's a gangster, you know, for attacking Libya. I mean, on the most scandalous reasons, even after we saw what happened in Iraq. You know, and you see what happened in Syria.
Well, the drones. I mean, the drones are the...
Yeah, the drones.
Indefensible.
Yeah, so they sit there. So they sit there and go, "Wait a second, you're crying," and rightfully so. If it is, I don't know whether his tears were sincere over the school children dying in Connecticut. But you don't care about the drones that you know, when people are picking firewood in Afghanistan and you knock out, you know, 26 people in a family,
when Clinton was president, didn't he bomb for 4 days some area in Africa? It was like there was a chemical factory there. They wanted to dismantle.
Which country that was? Oh boy, was that Afghanistan? I think that was Afghanistan.
No, I think it was in Africa. It was in Africa, and they killed a few thousand people. A few thousand people were killed.
I'm losing you, Carl. I got to let you go. Go ahead.
Yeah, finish it off. Right. It was. In order
to arrest Noriega, you bombed downtown Panama and killed 4,500 people.
It was.
You know, I mean, it's just crazy. We're the gangsters. I mean, and Putin's the gangster. I'm not saying he isn't. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't use that word gangster, but I'm just saying. Wait a second. Look at who's setting the world on fire. Look at all the military bases. So what do you think? TPP is about military bases. And that's what that's about.
Very part of it. It's a big part of it. I agree with that. Thanks for the call. They want control of Singapore and have the straits there and make it harder for China. In 1998, Clinton greenlighted a cruise missile strike against a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. Allegedly, it was being used, the factory, to make chemicals that Al-Qaeda might be using to kill people. Turns out that allegation was false. And the loss of the factory did result in, according to Germany's ambassador to Sudan, several tens of thousands of deaths because of the shortage of medicines. The essential medications were no longer available. Just something to think about. Phone number 844-4HALG. We will come back. We do have thought wrestler Danny Cardwell coming up on the morning show. 844-4HALG.
Hi, everybody. This week, we continued our mission to destroy ISIL. This remains a difficult fight, and the situation in Syria and Iraq is incredibly complex. ISIL's entrenched, including in urban areas. It uses innocent civilians as human shields. Despite these challenges, though, I can report that we're making progress. And this week, I directed my team to continue accelerating our campaign on all fronts. Our 66-member coalition, including Arab partners, continues to grow stronger. more nations are making more contributions. Every day, our air campaign, more than 10,000 strikes so far, continues to destroy ISIL forces. And we continue to go after ISIL leaders and commanders, taking them out day in, day out, one after another after another. In Iraq, ISIL has now lost more than 40% of the areas it once controlled. In Syria, a coalition of local forces is tightening the squeeze on ISIL's stronghold of Raqqa. As we bomb its oil infrastructure, ISIL's been forced to slash salaries of its fighters. Thanks to the work of many nations, the flow of foreign terrorist fighters into Syria finally appears to be slowing. In short, in Syria and Iraq, ISIL's territory is shrinking, there are fewer ISIL fighters on the battlefield, and it's harder for them to recruit and replenish their ranks. Still, the only way to deal ISIL a lasting defeat is to end the civil war and chaos in Syria upon which ISIL thrives. A cessation of hostilities in the civil war is scheduled to take effect this weekend. Now, we're not under any illusions. There are plenty of reasons for skepticism. And even under the best of circumstances, the violence will not end right away. But everyone knows what needs to happen. All parties must end attacks, including aerial bombardment. Humanitarian aid must be allowed to reach areas under siege. And a lot of this is going to depend on whether the Syrian regime, Russia, and their allies live up to their commitments. The coming hours and days will be critical, and the world is watching. That said, there will be absolutely no ceasefire in our fight against ISIL. We will remain relentless. Beyond Syria and Iraq, we continue to use the full range of our tools to go after ISIL wherever it tries to take root, as we showed with our recent strike on an ISIL training camp in Libya. With partners around the world, we'll continue discrediting the ideology that ISIL uses to radicalize and recruit and inspire people to violence, especially online. Finally, we'll continue to stay vigilant here at home, including trying to identify lone actors or small groups of terrorists like those in San Bernardino, which are harder to detect. Our homeland security and law enforcement professionals are hard at work 24/7. At the same time, we'll keep working to build partnerships of trust and respect with communities to help them stay strong and resilient. And all of this includes upholding our values, including freedom of religion, so that we stay united as one American family. This fight against ISIL will remain difficult, but we will continue to draw on all elements of our national power, including the strength of our communities and our values as Americans. And I am absolutely confident that we will prevail. We will destroy this barbaric terrorist organization and continue to stand with those around the world who seek a better and safer future.
All right, we're back on the Ginsburg Show. We do have thought wrestler Danny Cardwell with us. I was going to call you Danny Tartable because it's sort of – have you ever been called Danny
Kansas City Royals baseball, right?
Yeah, I think he played for the Yankees too, so I don't know why that's in my head. But the it's sort of Cardwell – anyway, I want to – you know what? I'm going to throw the script out. Danny and I always have – I think it's – we try to be very honest as I try. I know he is. So let me play this. This was audio from earlier in the show. This is Jake Tapper questioning Trump about the – he didn't quite get endorsed by, I guess, the neo-Nazi, the former Nazi KKK guy, David Duke. But here's the question from Tapper.
Condemn David Duke and say that you don't want his vote or that of other white supremacists in this election?
Well, just so you understand, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? I don't know anything about what you're even talking about with white supremacy or white supremacists. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Did he endorse me or what's going on? Because, you know, I know nothing about David Duke. I know nothing about white supremacists. And so you're asking me a question that I'm supposed to be talking about people that I know nothing about.
But I guess the question from the Anti-Defamation League is, even if you don't know about their endorsement, there are these groups and individuals endorsing you. Would you just say unequivocally you condemn them and you don't want their support?
Well, I have to look at the group. I mean, I don't know what group you're talking about. You wouldn't want me to condemn a group that I know nothing about. I'd have to look. If you would send me a list of the groups, I will do research on them. And certainly I would disavow if I thought there was something wrong. But you may have groups in there that are totally fine, and it would be very unfair. So give me a list of the groups, and I'll let you know.
Okay. I mean, I'm just talking about David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan here, but...
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know David Duke. I don't believe I've ever met him. I'm pretty sure I didn't meet him, and I just don't know anything about him.
All right, that's pretty bad, Danny. How bad is that?
Well, it's only bad if you were, you know, surprised in thinking that Donald Trump, you know, didn't understand and know the groups that were supporting and backing him. I think it would be a hard stretch to convince someone in Louisiana that Donald Trump didn't know who David Duke was. I mean, I think, you know, for maybe some of his supporters, so maybe they'll, you know, buy that excuse, that reasoning, and, you know, it'll be another reason for them to look past what's been obvious for the better part of 6 months now, but it doesn't surprise a lot of people.
So this doesn't really change your views one way or the other regarding Trump?
Well, no, because I don't think I ever really held his rhetoric in high esteem. I mean, the moment you start your campaign with, you know, they're sending in rapists and killers, and I assume some of them are good people. I mean, at that moment, that's the platform that this has been built on. And at every turn, you know, whoever the, you know, whichever group was that, you know, outside of the norm or the small minority group that, you know, can feel his wrath or his tension, you know, so it doesn't surprise me, no. It doesn't, no.
All right, let me play. This
I think
is.
I'm surprised that more people are surprised.
So you're surprised that people are surprised.
Yeah, that's my surprise, is that people are surprised and shocked.
Is this not basically your Republican Party? I mean, I know there seems to be a desire to make Trump, I guess, worse than the other two leaders, but on the issues they seem pretty similar. Is there a difference in style and rhetoric that makes Trump, in your view, and I know you have the hashtag Stop Trump that you used to tweet with, is there something about him that makes him worse, or is it just he's the front runner, so that's the one we have to stop?
Well, no, the genius of Donald Trump is that he's, you know, built on the cult of personality that has always had an influence on our society and our culture, and so... At this moment, you know, he has done what promoters do. He is, you know, he's gathered himself and he has, you know, harnessed this energy and he's built upon it. And so the fact that he has been able to, without saying anything policy specific, garner so much support to win so many delegates this early into the race, and to go into Super Tuesday with a head full of momentum and, you know, maybe winning 9 or 10 states, it's a fascinating and also a dangerous specter.
Well, doesn't it say, I mean, what it says to me is that the people are just so angry and disenchanted with both parties. I mean, these are presumably more conservatives, you know, that's more conservative people who are supporting Trump. But the extremism comes from a sense, does it not, that both parties have abandoned the people who are supporting Trump?
Inside of his core group of supporters are people who have, I think you correctly expressed, have felt left out of the American dream, felt left out of the conversation. The reality is that the economic pressures that people are feeling forces you to look for another way out. It forces you to look for someone to blame. If you're getting up and you're going to work and you're working hard every day and you're trying to save what little money you can, and the incredible financial burdens placed on a family are stacking up on you more and more, and you're doing your part, but it's just not happening. I mean, that's a level of anxiety and existential angst that not everyone can carry around. And so if you have an outlet for that anger, if you can scapegoat someone, if you can, you know, in your mind, understand that, well, I'm doing my part and this isn't happening, it must be someone else. And if someone is telling you that, indeed, it is someone else, and here's how, and, you know, and you're blaming the systemic problems that all of us face on a small group of people who are powerless in the face of the economic realities of our time, then, you know, it's the wrong person to maybe blame, but at least it's someone.
We've got Danny Cardwell with us, the Thought Wrestler, thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com, and he's got a number of great articles and posts up there. My good friend Eric Watry is linked to. I've had him on the show as well. Bernie's Dream is Set in a Nightmare, and that was posted late last week that addresses the unlikelihood of Bernie Sanders accomplishing the his stated goals if he were elected president. Right now we're talking about the Donald Trump candidacy. What would you recommend that Democrats, and I guess, can we agree at this point it looks pretty darn sure Hillary Clinton will be the next Democratic nominee? Now, I'm not saying she's going to be the nominee, but the odds look very, very favorable after the South Carolina election, does it not, Danny?
Well, I would say that if it was a betting event, that no one would be betting too heavily on Bernie right now. And after four events, you know, the plurality of support that Hillary had in South Carolina doesn't look good going into the South. But I think that we...
When you say plurality, you mean the low voter turnout in South Carolina or that Bernie had? Because I think you said Hillary. Maybe I misunderstood. It sure doesn't look good for Bernie. He couldn't win any demo except for under 30 in South Carolina. But the Democratic turnout, all told, was way down.
Oh, yeah.
From
08. Very, very low turnout.
And this is exactly what you predicted in Virginia. Bernie can't win Virginia, neither can Hillary, which is that neither candidate, or in total, the two candidates aren't exciting voters in these states. And Virginia is a swing state. Democrats aren't going to win South Carolina no matter what, but they really need Virginia. It's important. I don't think they need it. It's part of the new Democratic coalition of states. How do you respond if you're Hillary Clinton and you want to excite more voters to vote for you? How do you respond to a Trump who clearly is exciting a decent number of voters?
Well, without trying to predict the future, I would say that, you know, 2 months from now, the dust will be settled and there will be, you know, clear winners and losers. And the choice that Americans face in November will maybe, and I hope I might, much more certain choice. If the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party, if the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, if they feel so disinterested in the November race, that could spell disaster for the Democrats' chances of retaking the Senate. It could definitely cause us to lose ground in the House, and ultimately it could affect the presidential race. The stakes in 2016, you know, it's not that we have a 2016 election where we're going to dramatically improve the quality of life that everyone lives in this country in a four-year cycle. What we could do is lose the little gains that we've made, and we could lose them rather quickly. Progress is always hard, but dismantling progress is easy. I can tear down a house faster than you could build one, Hal. And the floor that we stand on, you know, we've seen it with the Voting Rights Act being dismantled. And now for some states, that's not a big problem. But there are states where we've seen already, you know, local and state legislatures enact laws to make voting that much more difficult for people. So, you know, progress is always the harder road, but we can tear something apart real quick. I mean, I could knock your house down quicker than you could rebuild it.
Well, one
and
of
I
my
think that's what's at stake at 2016.
one of my big fears is, and this would be the case if my guy were winning, but is an even bigger fear with Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I posted last week at my site why I'm voting for Clinton, something like that, if she wins. And I will. And, I mean, the latest issue with Trump is only makes it more certain that I would vote for Hillary Clinton in the, I call it the general presidential. But one of my concerns is she's not exciting voters. We see neither candidate, or in total, they're not exciting voters. Turnout is way down. I guess my question is, do you have an idea how she could go about exciting more voters? And this includes, you know, the African-American vote, which was down. I know that the total percentage, the percentage of black voters in South Carolina was up versus in 2008, but that was more a reflection, or that reflects that the number of white South Carolinians who voted in the primary were way down, and the number of African Americans who voted was only down slightly. Not that there was a big, huge turnout of African American voters. So I guess my question, Danny, is do you see a message that Hillary Clinton can start to broadcast that will excite the Obama coalition, which was African American voters, youthful voters, students? I'm just, because that was a really unprecedented, I think, the way he won that election. In the past, Clinton won with, you know, we didn't even get 50% of the vote. Jimmy Carter won just over 50% in 76. We're going back to the 70s to find a previous Democratic president, and that was in the wake of Watergate. So I guess I'm wondering if there's a way for Hillary Clinton to bring Democrats together the way Bernie has tried and so far has not succeeded.
Well, again, a lot of that is going to come with, you know, if Donald Trump is the candidate, will the reaction to that be strong enough to enlist that kind of left wing of the Democratic Party, moderates in the middle, and unite those independent folks, which, you know, this mythical demographic, I've never really met an independent, but, you know, that could just be me. But, you know, will that coalition be strong enough to stop, you know, a Donald Trump presidency if he wins that nomination? And as far as her making arguments, I don't know that she could fundamentally change what she's doing now. I mean, I don't know if she could change the tone or the rhetoric of her campaign in a way that would be more exciting than it is now. At that point, I don't know what you could do to, I mean, it's been the majority of the average voter's life that the Clintons have been in their life. I mean, at this point, if someone said they didn't know who Bill or Hillary Clinton was, I mean, you'd want to take a pulse next. I mean, so I don't know if, you know, I don't know if the excitement, I don't know what she could do as far as changing her campaign that would enlist more excitement. At this point, people know who she is, and, you know, she has very fervent supporters, and then there's some people in the middle that maybe will, you know, hold their nose and vote for, but I just don't know as far as excitement, you know, what could be done. I mean, excitement's not everything, because we've seen Bernie for 6 months have a lot of excitement. We haven't seen that turn into legislative results. We haven't seen that turn into electoral success, so to speak. I mean, he did very well in New Hampshire. He held his ground in Iowa, and, you know, Nevada was, for some people, see, he did better. Some people think he underperformed, but, you know, it hasn't translated. So I don't know if excitement alone is enough. I mean, would she take more excitement? I'm sure there are campaign staffers that would say, yeah, well, we'd love a, you know, 20,000 crowd appearance. We'd love to be in some, you know, hall with 15,000 people. I'm sure they would, but, you know, if it doesn't translate, it, I don't think it matters.
Talking to Danny Cardwell, he is the Thought Wrestler, thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com. Before we move on, now you're living in the Shenandoah region of Virginia, is that correct? I want to make sure I get everything right.
Blue Ridge Mountains, Hot Springs.
Is there, I mean, because and one of the ways that I find frustrating in Clinton's campaigning, and I may, this is the way I sort of see it, is she, it seems to me, divides the, or she implies in her campaigning that the interests of black and white voters are to a degree, not completely, in opposition. Is it your sense that that is how life is perceived in the rural, not deep South, but mid South, that basically what's good for black people is bad for me if I'm white, and the reverse? Is that the sense that people have? And I hope it isn't, but I fear it may well be to a degree.
Well, you know, we talk about the Dixiecrats or the Reagan Democrats or the people who left the party around the time of civil rights legislation and voting rights. And then we talk about the disenchantment that so many working class whites in the South feel with both parties. And when they hear specific, and I don't mean to generalize, but I've heard people say this, I live in and amongst the South, I live in the South. But when they hear targeted solutions for problems facing African Americans, you know, that can be alienating. At the same time, you know, there's a specific set of problems black people face that our white counterparts don't. And to deny that reality, you know, while it might make some of our brothers and sisters in the South feel better, it's an uncomfortable conversation. It doesn't change the reality on the ground.
Let me get Chris on. Chris, hold for one sec, because I know you were just calling. Chris, on with the thought wrestler, Danny Cardwell. Chris, yeah, want to jump right into this?
Yeah, hello, Hal?
Yes, you are on with Danny and Hal.
Yes, good morning. I have a question for the thought wrestler. And my question is this. What is his ideas, and how can we promote mandatory voting? Would mandatory voting have helped Bernie Sanders do a lot better?
And wait, Chris, don't jump off, because I know sometimes you ask the question, you take the answer off the air, but I want you to stick with us and listen to Danny, and then maybe if you have a response. Go ahead, Danny Cardwell, mandatory voting, your thoughts.
I don't think mandatory voting would be, I mean, voting is a right. It is a right that we have to participate in democracy, and to make voting mandatory, you know, that again, it gets to the question of choice. And some people choose not to engage. Some people choose to accept, you know, the will of others imposing, you know, things on their lives, and it's easier for them not to think. I don't know how mandatory voting would work. If someone could formulate a way to make that work, you know, that would be fine. But I just don't think that mandatory voting would, because it mandatory voting doesn't necessarily, I think the question should be, you know, and it's a brilliant question, but how do we get more people involved in the process? And so, I mean, it's two sides of the same coin, but, you know, I don't know that we can make people vote. You know, I don't know how that would work. It is true. We need more participation, but that has to be a choice people want to make. People have to want to be part of the solution.
Go ahead, Chris. Anything in response?
Yes. I think one of the ways mandatory voting would work would be the same way that we pay taxes and how that works. Taxes are involuntary, mandatory, and we have a better society because we pay taxes. I think that we would have a much better society if voting would be more or less in a vein of patriotism, like the other 26 countries that have mandatory voting. When those other 26 countries have mandatory voting, there seems to be a decline in corruption. When there is mandatory voting, as I said before, in other countries, the mandatory voting has a tendency to represent college students, poor people, and those that are marginalized. Yes, I would agree with President Barack Obama when he said that mandatory voting is something that we should look into. Before we get up in the morning, our government takes money out of our pockets because in a capitalistic society, money is more important than what a person thinks. I think that my vote is more important than taxes. I think that my vote would direct where taxes would go in our society. And that's why I think mandatory voting is very patriotic, and we need it in this country.
All right, Chris, great call. Thank you. Thank you for the call, Chris. I'll let him go, but you go ahead and respond if you want. Danny, we only have a few moments. Go ahead.
I appreciate Chris, and, you know, that is a, you know, that's something maybe to be looked in, but, you know, I'm just troubled by the specter of forcing people to do something. Let me tell you, this has been my experience in politics, Hal. This is where real change happens. You're an avid Bernie supporter. Anyone that has listened to your show or read your work knows that. There, amongst Bernie supporters, there's been an excitement. They've shown up at rallies. They have, fervently on social media defended Bernie's calls and the right to champion social and economic change in this country. Do you know where I do not see this same intensity? I don't see this intensity when I show up at local and city municipal buildings for county meetings, for city and state budget meetings. I don't see this same intensity in off years elections. You know, the 2010 census year election has doomed us for a decade. Low voter turnout. The fact that in any town, any small town USA, any city USA, you can show up on the night that the local politics, the local business is being done, and we're absent. And so if you, in some ways, this coalition and this movement and my animosity towards them has never been towards Bernie. I've never written anything negative towards Bernie. I'm writing against the Demos, against that part of our progressive wing of the party that feels like an election is enough, and it's not enough. We have to do the work on the ground. We have to sit down at budget meetings where it's long and it's boring and people are voting on line items. We have to show up and make our voices heard at the local level, and we just don't do that. So, I mean, I think that's where the movement is. That's where the politics are. If you can't affect, I mean, you know, not to put you on the spot, but when was the last time you were at a city council meeting in your community, Hal?
I went not too long ago. There was a meeting. I don't know if I call it city council, but in January, it was a. I guess this isn't really fair, but there was a transportation meeting, and all the candidates for the 8th congressional district were there to talk about their solutions for the transportation problems we face in Montgomery County. So I feel like that was kind of a political, you know, gathering.
And I can almost bet that at that gathering that there wasn't a noticeable presence of, you know, our movement represented.
There were a lot of people, but I would agree with you. It wasn't notably progressive by any means. There was a big turnout, and people were expressing their wishes, which was basically more public transportation. I mean, that was what people wanted, was more public transportation. And I don't know that we're going to get it. And I don't know we're going to get cheaper, you know, more affordable public transportation either.
Here's my greater point in that issue, is that the rhetoric that we see Donald Trump express has been coupled with, on the right, inside of these small rural towns in my community, I speak specifically of Southwest Virginia, those voices are heard at the local level. You talk about Montgomery County, Maryland. You go to Montgomery County in Virginia, where Virginia Tech is. You go to those meetings, and there's not, you know, 30, 40 kids from Virginia Tech in there making their voices heard. You know, you go to Charlottesville. You go to Orange or Greene County. You don't have kids you don't have our movement. You don't have our kids reflected in the meetings. And so that's where the work is. And it's easier to, you know, think that you can show up and then Bernie will do it. And that's, I think, that savior complex, and I use that word, savior complex, that many Southern Democrats the animosity that many of them have had towards Bernie's supporters, not Bernie, but Bernie's supporters, is that democracy has to be an action.
But don't you think, Dan, let me just interrupt you because we don't have a whole lot of time. I hear what you're saying, but don't you think that even if that's a legitimate critique of Bernie's supporters who say, hey, just vote for Bernie, just vote for Bernie, Bernie Sanders has said over and over, I need you. We need to do it together. The only way we can make real change is if we vote for a whole new Congress, if we vote for local leaders who represent our interests. I mean, he's been really upfront. I mean, I think your criticism, in a way, is really shows support for what he's trying to do. And, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong in what you're saying about his supporters, but I think, in a way, what you're saying is, you support what he wants to do.
And I actually, even in the piece, went on to write, I mean, if Bernie's ultimate goal is to push the conversation so far to the left that compromise means that we get incremental gains, then he's a genius. And I think that that's the genius, could be the genius of this campaign. But, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you beat on a drum at a Bernie rally, then you show up and vote, and that's it. No, you show up, you vote, and then you go to your local and city council meetings. You don't go there and just listen. You go there and you participate. You know, you make sure that your voice and that the progressive voice is heard inside of those meetings, and you make it uncomfortable. I don't say impossible, but you make it uncomfortable for people to vote.
Don't you think that? A young lady who was at the Clinton fundraiser, who was carrying the sign with, her phrase, we must bring them to heel. That was a statement Clinton made in 96 where she was praising the bill her husband had signed 2 years earlier. I mean, isn't that exactly what you're talking about, getting out there, making – so, I mean, I think we are seeing it to a degree. I just don't think nearly enough. You know, again, the voter turnout has been down, and that includes his votes, too, obviously, and they were way down compared to Clinton in 08 when she lost the election. We don't have, you know, you can stay with me as long as you like, Danny. I don't want to keep you past your time. It's 10:34 now. But I wanted to just follow up with a question about, you said you don't know whether there's something Clinton can do that would bring us together. And I want to give a proposal. I think that could help. And this is it addresses also your point where, you know, there are specific problems in the African-American communities in the South, in the rural South, and they're different from problems in the white communities in the rural South, and they may have some similar interests, but some are different. What about if she came out with a very, very strong, plausible plan for creating more middle-class jobs across the country, bringing some manufacturing back here, raising the wages that are paid in retail, which is where most people now are working. At least that's where the new jobs are. Don't you think if she talked about the importance of creating new jobs, that could start to build a movement? And obviously, I think that, but I'm curious what you think.
Well, I think she has talked about that, but if she was to make that more central to her campaign, then, you know, that could be something that that could unite people. But I think that if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, that at some point her strength in, you know, whether or not we agree with policies or not, the fact that she knows world leaders' names and the events and the location of these places on a map gives her an advantage over Donald Trump, who has, you know, through 6 months not made a cogent argument on his foreign policy. I mean, bombing, excuse me, the hell out of someone doesn't stand up against, you know, the war policies that have been written in the past, or strategies for peace in that matter. So the fact that she has an obvious head start on foreign affairs is a place that I think that if those two were matched up, she would try to draw a clear distinction. But at some point, you know, it's more exciting for people to, you know that jobs are going to be coming, or that someone's at least thinking about them, than a country that maybe some people can't even find on a map.
Thanks so much for joining me, Dan. It's always a pleasure. I learned so much from you, and hey, happy If I mentioned this in the email. Chris had chided me the other day for not talking about Black History Month. How important do you believe it is to talk about Black History Month? Why is it important?
Well, it's for two important reasons. One reason is for children in the early development of a self, the cultivating of that unique thing that makes you you. For Black kids going through an education in the public school systems, if you don't have people that are specifically, you know, pointing out to you that you're much more than what the history books say about you, you know, it can do damage to you when coupled with, you know, some of the economic realities that people in inner cities face. That education in Black history is something that can fortify a person. So if you look at HBCU graduates, historically Black college and university graduates, they do better in the long run, and there's studies that have, you know, proven this. They do better in the long run than their counterparts that went to public or private, predominantly white institutions. And it's not because the math is different. It's not because social studies is different. It's not because, you know, ethics or politics or whatever course they study is taught differently. But it's because in the human interactions that you have, you see people that look like you, that are professionals, that have PhDs, that are aspiring to achieve and accomplish more in life. And that reinforces in you that maybe some of the negative things that you have been taught, you know, whether intentional or unintentionally, about yourself in the past should be called into question. And so that's one thing that, you know, even as a Christian, as someone who has been an ordained member of a church, who is a member of a historically Black church that has done a lot of good to help advance the cause of civil rights, that's one thing I give Nation of Islam and some of the other Muslim faiths inside of the United States credit for, because inside of their children, they instill in them an amount of self-worth and identity. And so that's why Black history is important.
Thanks so much, Danny. Again, I learned so much from you. I really appreciate that you give us your time. And I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Have a great day. Have a great afternoon.
You have yourself a great day, and I hope your listeners have great days as well. Peace.
All right. Danny Cardwell, peace to you as well. The Thought Wrestler, thoughtwrestler.blogspot.com. And we had him for just about 40 minutes, just a little under that. I really appreciate his time. I hope you do. I'm sure you do as well. I'll tell you what, let's hit that break. I'll let him go at this point. Very brief break, just a minute. And I've got a lot more to talk about. I do want to talk about the Academy Awards and play for you the monologue from Chris Rock. We'll be back after this.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Eric Wustewald. As Donald Trump continues to dominate the GOP primary, Republicans, such as former presidential candidate Mitt Romney, are calling for the billionaire businessman to make public his past tax returns. Fox's The Five discussed the importance of the issue, and co-host Kimberly Guilfoyle took to Trump's defense.
I have no doubt that no matter what he does end up releasing, people are like, okay, well, so he did, whatever. I don't think it's going to be anything earth-shattering. Look, if you want to see it, check him out. Go see it by all means, by everyone. It just feels like this is a Democrat tactic.
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute.
Wait, Trump did it.
What about the discrimination,
now?
Juan?
Well, hang on.
That's why Romney is making the point.
And one percenters. Yes. Nobody ever asked to see that before. It's so rude. It's like, you know what? You're rich. You got money. Show me your money. Show me your pockets. Show me your tax returns.
Guilfoyle's assertion of discrimination against the rich is so out of touch with reality, it could only be found on Fox News. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Yeah, that is quite astonishing. The solicitude for the poor rich kids and rich parents and rich grandparents. All right, Dow down 23 points. To 16,617, NASDAQ plus 3 to 4,593, S&P 500 down 2 to 1946, gold's up 14 an ounce, currently priced at 1234, oil is up 43 cents a barrel at $33.21. We'll get to the Chris Rock monologue from last night, a lot of good stuff there. But before we do, I did want to just get Carl's response to Douglas. Benefit of the doubt. I didn't say Douglas was defending Trump. I said he was giving him the benefit of the doubt, like he didn't quite hear the question. Give me a break. Well, I don't think that's fair, though, to Douglas, because Douglas kind of said he wasn't going to defend Trump. I think he said, I'm not going to defend Trump. I think that's where he was with that. All right, 844-4-HAL-G if you want to join me, 844-367-4254. And here is the opening monologue last night from the Oscars, Chris Rock. Let's see if we get there. Yeah, here we go.
I think I should.
Sometimes I don't always get the audio like I'm supposed to. Oh, I see why. By the way, for what it's worth, yeah, it is Black History Month, and Chris Rock talks about African-American history in his monologue. I think that's important. Let's go to it again. Well, let's try one more time.
Hey, yo! Thank you, thank you, thank you! Woo! Man, I counted at least 15 black people on that montage. Hey! Well, I'm here at the Academy Awards, otherwise known as the White People's Choice Awards. You realize, if they nominated host, I wouldn't even get this job. So y'all be watching Neil Patrick Harris right now. But here's the crazy thing. This is the wildest, craziest.
Let me just stop that for a second. First of all, I think Rock looks great. He really does. He looks really good in the white dinner jacket. Really, he has a good look there. He looks young. I don't know, how old is he? He must be in his 40s by now. He looks quite good. The comment about Neil Patrick Harris, I really appreciated, because I think that guy was such a 51. Chris Rock is 51. He's 2 years younger than I am. Well, he looks good. Wish I looked that good. I didn't realize he was that young. He was almost my age. Wow. Okay, well, Patrick Harris, I thought was the worst choice to be the host. He's so bland. I know he sings and dances, but there's nothing exciting about him. Kind of, remember there was Hugh Jackman? Kind of I think it tells you where Neil Patrick Harris is in my estimation, that I would call him the poor man's Hugh Jackman. I'm glad they went with a comedian. I'm glad they went with somebody who's funny, Chris Rock. Apparently the ratings were down last night. I don't know if you can blame Chris Rock for that. It was not a compelling show. I got a lot more to play, but I'll tell you what, I don't like to keep listeners holding at all. So let's go to John in Seaside. At some point I may have to do, because if I'm going to get lots and lots of calls, I have to have cues and only have people call at certain points. But for now, I just love to get the call, so you call in at any time. 844-367-4254. John in Seaside, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Hal. Hey, I just wanted to give you my take on Trump. I don't really see him as being, I see him as a guy who's giving the GOP a taste of their own medicine. The GOP has been taunting us, Democrats, since Obama's been in office. They're basically can take these extreme positions and get away with it. And so, you know, they get up on the camera, on national TV, and they lie. And they know that most Democrats know they're lying, and they don't care. Well, here's Trump. He's running in their party. He's saying all these extreme things that he knows it's going to completely tank him in the general election, but the GOP base loves it. There's a majority of the GOP base who just loves it, even despite the fact that all these other guys who are running are saying, oh, that's not right to say that, you know, kick all these people out or do this or do that. That's not right. You know, they're having to distance themselves from it, but their base loves it. So he's taunting them. He's doing the same thing to them that they've been doing to us.
I'll tell you something else. Just to segue off that for a little bit, is he's going after the Republicans. I mean, and I think that's what you're saying. I'm saying a little bit different way. He's giving them a taste of their own medicine, yes, but he is sometimes on occasion, like when he called out W for not keeping us safe and for screwing up the war, he is speaking truth to power to a degree. And I think that's very refreshing for us on the left. We're very happy to see that and hear that.
I see him more as a secret agent than, you know, an actual GOP candidate. I think he's just there. I think he's just a court jester that jumped into the game and decided he's going to make a mockery out of the whole thing. If it was even possible to make more of a mockery out of, you know, their electoral process, you know, that goes on their side. But I'm enjoying every minute of it. I love it.
Are you then hoping he'll be the Republican nominee, or you won't go that far? You just enjoy the spectacle he is presenting?
Yes, I hope he's the nominee because, one, both Democratic candidates poll well against him, or, you know, at least Sanders does, and Clinton, he's right now the poll.
I think she does better against him than against the other Republicans, as a matter of fact. But
yeah.
I don't know if I buy that's the way it will wind up, but anyway, it's true.
According to the polls, he's the only one that Clinton can beat, and it looks like Clinton is going to be our candidate. So, obviously, I want him to get nominated. But the other thing is, too, he is, despite a lot of the terrible things he said, he is their most liberal candidate. He just is. And so, you know, for that reason, I would also like to see.
So you're saying he's A, their least electable, but B, his policies are less noxious than the other candidates are. I mean, they're not that they're not noxious, but they're less noxious.
I think the aggregate of his policies are less noxious. Obviously, some are more noxious, you know, wanting to deport 11 million people. I think there are things about what he's saying, like if he were actually, and nobody would allow him to do that. But, I just think as you said, didn't he said there needs to be some sort of national health care program.
He's talking about national health care. He does say he's against the trade deals. And I think we don't get how terrible those deals have been. I mean, I don't think the American people many do, but I don't think it's individuals do, but I don't think it's in the collective consciousness how, you know, the NAFTA and the CAFTA and the Columbia deal and all these deals, Korea, in the aggregate have done such terrible harm, such grievous harm to so many millions of Americans. I don't think people get that. And Trump has said, hey, you know, I'm against them, whereas that's not Hillary Clinton's view. Hillary Clinton said, yeah, when I look at TPP, there's not enough in there for me to feel comfortable signing. That's what she said. I don't know if I believe her, but that's what she said. But she also makes it very clear she supports those comprehensive trade deals. And yet they have been, I think, as harmful as anything to the American middle class over the past 35, 36 years.
Yeah, I worry that if she gets elected, she'll just, you know, despite the fact that she's been speaking out against it as of late, I feel that she'll just do an about-face on that and sign it anyhow. I mean, or the TPP's already mostly gotten through, right? It's just
to
be ratified.
Well, it has to be ratified by Congress and then signed by the president. The president could veto it.
Okay. Well, and then the other thing is the Keystone Pipeline. I've been hearing a lot about her being, I don't think she's really mentioned that much.
I think she said she was against it, but it was taken off the table because it's not going to happen, right? I mean, the president said the president said we're not doing it. The State Department said it's not going to happen, and they needed some approvals that they didn't get. So it's just, as far as I know, it's done. Unless then they have to go through a whole new, very long, lengthy, years and year long process to get it approved. So it does not look like this is going to happen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the permit was denied, so they'd have to start the permitting process all over again.
Oh, okay.
Which could take years and years.
Yeah,
and years.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, yeah, I called in to say that about Trump. I see people. I think when the general election comes around, it's really the time to bash him. I don't think that we have anything to gain by slamming him. And I do think that it's a little bit ironic that Hillary supporters slam Trump so hard, just because, not because of any, you know, any similarities that there may be in the outcome of their policies, but the fact that, I'm sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought on that, Hal. It's early.
That's
for me
all right,
right,
honey. Take care. I'll let you go. Go. Enjoy. Too much beer last night is my guess. Take care.
No.
All right, John.
I'll call back.
All right. From Carl again. Very good interview. He's talking about Danny, one of the better people you have on the show. He is great. Cardwell is great. I love to have him every week, but he just doesn't have the time. But once every 2 weeks is really good. All right, 844-4-HAL-G, 844-367-4254, 844-4-HAL-G. We know one superdelegate has endorsed Bernie Sanders. Tulsi Gabbard announced that yesterday. I played the video. She is a Hawaiian congresswoman, and she's very, very good. She's very telegenic. She did a nice video for him and explained, based on her service to our nation in the military, he's the only candidate she could support because he will not get us involved in destructive foreign wars. Well, we've got another superdelegate who just announced, I got it in my email, from Alan Grayson, the congressman with guts. He's running for Senate. He has felt the burn. He did an online survey to see whether he should support Bernie or Hillary. And he has concluded, based on the votes, that Sanders is his guy. Sanders winning 86%, Clinton 14%. So we see every time there's any kind of an online survey, Bernie wins big. Interestingly, that does jibe, doesn't it, with what the thought wrestler said. We don't get enough people out to the town meetings. We don't get enough people out to vote in the midterm elections and in the off-year elections. And we're seeing that in the primaries, too. The third of South Carolinians who were eligible to vote in the Democratic primary did so. It's very, very sad. It's terrible. 844-4-HAL-G, 844-367-4254. And I truly believe, and I want your take on this, if there's one way, any way, that Hillary Clinton, again, assuming that she will be the Democratic nominee, if there's any way Hillary Clinton could really start to build momentum going forward, going towards November, she would talk about building the economy in this country, creating better and more middle-class jobs. She would bring on her team people like Robert Reich. I know Reich has endorsed Bernie. But if she went to Robert and said, hey, I want to consult with you for, you know, advice, and you will be on my transition team and hopefully on my cabinet if you will serve, I think that would be huge for her. I think if she talked to Sherrod Brown, if she said, hey, this guy is going to be someone I'm going to go to on a regular basis when it comes to trying to improve the economy for poor working and middle income Americans, for hardworking Americans, that would be huge for her. I think if there was one way that she could start to, you know, build a snowball of support that could overwhelm Donald Trump, it would be to talk about jobs, to talk about communities across the land, whether it's inner city communities, whether it's rural communities, whether it's exurbs. This is how we're going to make things better for people who live in these communities. Sure, the minimum wage is a big deal. I would talk about the minimum wage, but I would talk even more about how to bring jobs back to this country. I don't think it's too late. That's what we hear. Some people say it's too late. The horse is out of the barn. I don't buy it. It's always too late, and then again, it's never too late. I don't see any. I think that should be her. You know, what did Danny say? He said she talks about it, but she doesn't focus on it. I think that should be the focus. Building jobs, bringing jobs back to America. Bernie talks about it, but he talks about jobs even more in the context of economic injustice, about how all the wealth that's being created is going to the top 1%. That's big. This game is rigged idea is very powerful. And it also explains Trump's support, Trump's rise, because his voters, his base are people who've been left behind. And so they're saying, hey, the game is rigged against me. And so they'll go with a demagogue. They'll go with a racist, or at least someone who, you know, enunciates racist tropes, who uses racism, who claims the president wasn't born in this country. That's a huge part of Trump's appeal. He gives people who have been left behind a victim, but he also stands apart from the establishment, Republican and Democratic establishment, that has done so much harm, that, you know, the people who live in poor, struggling, middle-income communities feel. Well, how do you address that if you're Hillary Clinton? Well, of course you reject the divisiveness, you reject the scapegoating, unless you want to scapegoat the people who are really responsible, the bankers, the financiers, the hedge fund managers. I have no problem with you doing that, which, by the way, Trump does to a degree also. But what she could do is go be, because when Bernie says the game is rigged and, you know, wealth goes to 1%, really that is a diagnosis. But the symptoms are stagnating wealth. The symptoms are no good jobs. The symptoms are people working harder and harder for less and less. Hillary Clinton can address that dynamic head on, and I think truly build momentum if she says, we're going to build jobs in this country. If you elect me, I'm going to do everything I can to bring middle-class jobs back to America, to create more middle-class jobs. And she's got to be real specific about how she's going to do it. No more trade deals. And we are going to raise taxes on the wealthy, so we'll have more spending. We'll have more of a stimulus. That's, you know what, folks? That's how we can win. And I hope that's what she does. I fear it will not be.
It's Thursday, February 25, 2016.
It was, it is, a simple case of letting the market work. We're going to let everybody compete.
Saudi Arabia declines to help U.S. oil companies survive oil's downturn. Big Coal's new trick to get out of paying retired coal miners' pensions. Sea levels rising faster than at any time in the last 3,000 years. Plus,
this is a global public good to invent something that can solve this problem.
Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates proposes a billion-dollar breakthrough energy research fund. So why aren't renewable energy experts happy?
I don't know, but I suspect we're about to find out. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Clean Power Plan aims to cut carbon pollution 32% below 2005 levels by 2030. That's not possible. Not without going back to the Stone Age. For one thing, you'd have to stop human beings from exhaling.
Well, all I can tell you is that this planet will be better off when Rush Limbaugh stops exhaling. Just saying. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, coal is in trouble. And now oil is in trouble. It's not a great time to be in the fossil fuel industry, it seems.
No, it certainly isn't. And it looks like we are going to see cheap oil for a while longer. At an annual oil industry conference in Houston this week, the Saudi Arabia oil minister confirmed that Saudi Arabia will not cut its own production in order to stop the global oil glut.
That is not going to happen because not many countries are going to deliver. Even if they say they will cut production, they will not deliver. So there is no sense in wasting our time seeking production cuts. Let some inefficient supplies decline, and eventually the market will balance.
Those inefficient supplies he's referring to are U.S. oil producers, whose costs are too high to survive much longer with such low prices. Saudi Arabia is keeping prices low in order to be the last oil producer standing.
Hey, it's the free market, U.S. oil producers. You guys love that, right?
Coal is also in decline in the U.S., with major coal companies now declaring bankruptcy. But big coal is using those bankruptcy laws to legally shed their employee pension and health care obligations and the environmental costs of cleaning up closed mines. There was a bipartisan aid package in Congress to restore coal miner pensions and health care, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from the coal state of Kentucky just blocked it.
You mean the Republicans aren't fighting like hell to take care of these coal miners who they say they must protect, and that's why we can't get rid of coal because, oh, the poor coal miners?
That's right.
They're hypocrites. Who saw that one coming?
Meanwhile, a new study finds that sea levels are now rising faster than at any time in the last 3,000 years, and that the rate is accelerating, especially over the last 100 years, thanks to man-made global warming. The researchers say if no action is taken to cut emissions, they calculate the ocean could rise as much as 4 feet by 2100 and will continue to rise for centuries. And yet another new study finds that cutting the emissions that cause global warming will also save more money than it costs. That's because it will save lives by reducing toxic air pollution, a leading cause of death worldwide. Researchers calculated that cutting emissions would ultimately save the U.S. economy alone about $250 billion a year by avoiding the health care costs from all the asthma, lung cancer, and heart disease that Americans will not be suffering. Billionaire Microsoft founder Bill Gates this week said he and other billionaires are going to mobilize billions in private capital for a new breakthrough clean energy research and development fund to combat climate change.
The group of private investors would bring several billion in so that we can nurture these companies up to a pretty large stage. But we do expect to make money out of this thing. It's great that we have that incentive, the financial incentives to get it out at scale quickly, and that's also the climate benefit requires that same mentality.
However, energy experts like Joe Rome at Climate Progress say that while they welcome new research funding, what we really need now is billions for deployment. We already have the technology we need, they say, to transition the world to renewable energy, but we need money to build it faster. And time spent on waiting on breakthroughs could be better spent building wind and solar and battery storage.
Yeah, but, you know, the guy who created Windows, for some reason, wants to make things way more complicated. I have no idea why. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Headed for the open door.
Right back on the Innsbruck Show, 11:05 on February 29th. It's Monday, 2016. One more hour. Your calls are always welcome. 844-4-HAL-G, 844-367-4254. I will get back to Rock's opening monologue from last night's Academy Awards. I don't know if I'll play all of it, but I'll certainly play more of it, and it's certainly appropriate. But I just wanted to talk about a story that I noticed in the paper yesterday. It actually was released a few days earlier. You may recall back in January, a story got an awful lot of attention by the news media, and it was a shocking story, that five teenage boys in Brooklyn had approached a man and his daughter at night on a Brooklyn playground, ordering the man away at gunpoint before gang raping the 18-year-old woman in public. Police arrested five teenagers, ages 14 to 17, very quickly afterwards. Turns out they were false charges. Turns out that the boys have all been released. Charges have been dropped. Why did this happen? Why were the charges brought in the first place? Well, they were brought based on the statement by the 18-year-old woman and her father that a gun had been held to his head and he had been told he had to leave while they then raped her. And there was evidence of sex in the case. There was DNA evidence. And, in fact, there had been sexual relations between the woman and at least one or more of the boys. It turns out that police are now saying that it was consensual, that the father had been previously having sex with his daughter in the park, that in fact the boys saw the father and daughter having sex, and the daughter apparently saw the boys, called them over, and then asked if they would, or the father asked if they wanted to have sex with her. And she said yes, apparently. There was video evidence that this was consensual. So, there you go. And there certainly was a racial element. I don't know whether the purported victim, the complaining witness, the woman, I don't know what her race was, but the boys who were charged were black. And there was certainly a free zone of racial tension involved. And New York Times and the Washington Post point out that there is some similarities to the Central Park case back in the 80s, where a jogger claimed to have been raped by, a white jogger claimed to have been raped by five teenagers. Gang raped. Turns out those charges were proven not to have been false in the sense that she was indeed raped, but that the boys who were arrested, DNA evidence exonerated. And so they were ultimately all released, and the city has paid them quite a bit, I believe, for false prosecution. The point is, you got to be really careful. We've got to be so careful about rushing to judgment. We've got to wait for the evidence to show whether somebody who's charged with a crime is guilty before we're confident that they're monsters, wild animals, super predators. I think it's really important. I'm glad that the media is making clear in these cases that there are false charges levied. I think this is look, it's just the killing by white cops on unarmed blacks is incredibly important that that be exposed. It's also important that some of the cases that scare people, they hear about, that they also be exposed as false allegations. Donald Trump in 1989, took out a full-page ad in four newspapers, bring back the death penalty in response to the allegation that five gang members, minority juveniles, four blacks and one Hispanic, raped a woman jogger. Turns out, again, they were not guilty, even after they were convicted, based on evidence that just was insufficient. And after a man confessed and DNA evidence showed they were not, none of them could be proven to have been involved. The DNA evidence couldn't exonerate them because, if they weren't the one who had, left their semen there, but it didn't confirm the convictions. and later on another man who was demonstrably guilty confessed. So I think it's really important we don't rush to judgment in cases where a victim seems very sympathetic and the facts are particularly horrific. 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. And that goes across the board. That goes for cases that go the other way, too. All right, I want to get to the, do I have it? Yeah, here, Chris Rock at the Oscars. This is February 28th, last night.
Man, I counted at least 15 black people on that montage. Hey! Well, I'm here at the Academy Awards, otherwise known as the White People's Choice Awards. You realize if they nominated hosts, I wouldn't even get this job. So y'all be watching Neil Patrick Harris right now. But here's the crazy thing. This is the wildest, craziest Oscars to ever host because we got all this controversy. There's no black nominees, you know? And people are like, Chris, you should boycott. Chris, you should quit. You should quit. You know, how come there's only unemployed people that tell you to quit something, huh? No one with a job ever tells you to quit. So I thought about quitting. I thought about it real hard. But I realized they're going to have the Oscars anyway. They're not going to cancel the Oscars because I quit, you know? And the last thing I need is to lose another job to Kevin Hart, okay? I don't need that. Kev right there. Kev make movies fast. Every month. Porno stars don't make movies that fast. Now, the thing is, why are we protesting? That's the big question. Why this Oscars? Why this Oscars? You know, it's the 88th Academy Awards. It's the 88th Academy Awards, which means this whole no black nominee thing has happened at least 71 other times. Okay? You gotta figure that it happened in the 50s, in the 60s. You know, like, you know, in the 60s, one of those years, Sydney didn't put out a movie. I'm sure there were no black nominees some of those years, say 62 or 63. And black people did not protest. Why? Because we had real things to protest at the time. You know?
So he's sort of saying this isn't that big a deal. And, of course, the white audience loves that line because they don't want to feel like there's something wrong going on here. And, I mean, Rock's got a good point. This is important, but it's not as important as civil rights. And he's going to give you a rundown of what's more important than the fact that there were no African-Americans nominated, which, you know, I think is awful. There's something clearly rotten in Hollywood. And we're not just talking about the actors either, by the way. But what about directors? How come there are no directors? How about movies with executive producers who are African-American? How about the other, you know, the non-performance awards, the cinematographers? And do they have the best screenplay? Best music, best musical score. I don't even know all of them. There's so many. Best documentaries. There's not one black in that entire list of all those nominees. Is that right? I don't know. There were a number of women in some of the non-acting categories. But as I understand it, is that right? There were none at all? Correct me if I'm wrong on this, because there might have been. I didn't watch the show. But to me, that's almost worse. How come behind the scenes, I mean, there are African-American stars. How come behind the scenes there are no or virtually no African-Americans who were nominated, who are doing this work? It's a lily white industry. 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. Black actors and directors were shut out. I'm not sure if some of the other categories included African-Americans. And I didn't watch, so I can't tell you, because I know they scan the crowd. But my sense is they were not. According to Anonymous here at Wall Street Journal blog, since 89, blacks have been nominated for 6% of the major awards and 9%. I don't have the numbers for the awards that aren't the big five, right? Best actor, supporting actress, actress, and director. So I don't have that except for the big five. I have given you what I believe is it's not the ultimate solution, but what we should be doing. We need to have a government filmmaking apparatus. The United States government should be making movies. We should be either doing it directly, employing people, and with a specific focus on making movies about, starring, written by, produced by people who are not represented in anywhere near their proportional numbers to our population. That's the first answer. Let's fund movies. Let's create movies. Let's make movies in this country with a specific focus on hiring and representing people who aren't normally, presented by Hollywood, who aren't part of the, I don't know, whatever's viewed as the monetizable or profitable demo. And by the way, Hollywood gets so much wrong. These guys are making mistakes all the time. I'll bet a lot of those government movies would do very well. I'm not saying that probably it would not be a good idea to have the U.S. government employees make them. You got to do them the way you would do any other movie. You fund it. You have deep pockets. You have angels, investors. And then people go to them and pitch their ideas. But their focus is going to always be on employing people who are not represented. People who are not part of demographic groups that are normally seen and making movies. It just seems like such an easy solution. And my guess is this would make money. My guess is this program would be profitable for the government. It makes just incredible amount of sense. All right, let's go to the phones. Caller, you're on with Hal. I also want to, before I actually take my call real quick, I also want to just point out, I do have a comment from Jeff that came in early this morning I want to respond to. But let's get Herb on first. Good morning, Herb.
Good morning, Hal.
Hello? Is this not Herb? Well, I thought it was. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, I got you. Go ahead. I had the wrong button pushed. I know people could hear you, but I couldn't. What's on your mind, my friend Herb?
Well, the CIA's been making propaganda films in Hollywood for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know that that's the kind of movie they actually make the for-profit movies are often propaganda, like the Tom Clancy movies and no question
right.
About that.
All those films that have military hardware, and it's some sort of reciprocal arrangement that they have. But why they call it Hollywood?
Well, the hills, I thought they were just, those were the Hollywood Hills. I don't know. Is there some story behind that I'm not aware of? Go ahead.
Well, I don't know why it's not generally known, but holly as a wood, the holly tree is one of the very whitest of woods, the inside.
I did not know that.
Yep, that's why they call it Hollywood.
Well, I mean, are there just a lot of holly trees in the region, or was there a deliberate decision to name the city after white trees, as opposed to
Well, that's
to
where it's kind of interesting,
mahogany.
Botanically. Botanically, I'm just positing that as the reason. But the reason they call, another part of why they called it Hollywood was because there's a tree that is indigenous to the to Southern California, known as Toyon, which is also known as a holly tree because it has red berries and kind of looks somewhat like holly.
It's sort of interesting because there are holly bushes too, right? Holly doesn't only grow as a tree, it also grows as a bush.
Right, exactly. It's a small tree or a large bush or, you know, varieties. Like manzanita, there's 45 different species in California.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
Ranging from ground cover to 45 foot.
I mean, you're saying a small tree, but I remember at my old house, the first house my wife and I lived in, there was a pretty good-sized holly tree that was well above. I mean, the top of that tree, I'm guessing, was 15 or 20 feet off the ground. That's not such a small tree. It wasn't like an apple tree or a little dwarf maple or something like that. I mean, this tree had a significant significant. It was a real tree.
Right. Well, that's the holly tree. The toyon usually doesn't grow that tall. But anyway,
what do you think of my idea? You don't like the government, though, right? You're sort of skeptical of government. But what do you think of my idea to have a government government film agency? Not that they necessarily themselves make the movies. In other words, government film agency employees wouldn't be the producers and the directors and the stars, but that they would be tasked with distributing money to people who will then make the movies. People that they, you know, have a plan and they present a script. And if you're good and you make a good pitch, you can make your movie. What do you think about that?
It's got the potential. I think there's, like you were saying about the Academy Awards, there's far more pressing situations to turn our hand to. I mean, not to say that it's a I do think it's good for people to have an awareness of the spectrum of cultural practices in this country, because a lot of people are, you know, they tend to be pretty isolated and they don't get out much and they live in their own world and, you know, they tend to see things through a very narrow focus and so
now, I don't think it's. I mean, that's what Chris Rock said. We have more important things, you know, in the '60s, and he's going to go on and list a variety of issues in the past. But I don't want to minimize this in any way. You know, our culture is who we are to a degree. I mean, yes, we create the culture, but the culture also creates us. So if we have this culture that presents the world is a kind of a upper middle class to rich New York and L.A. ideal as people live there, view it, and want it to be, I think that really is incredibly dismissive of experiences, and people are left who aren't able to, you know, share that worldview, haven't shared that experience. I think they're definitely left with a sense that their lives are less important, less meaningful. I mean, I think it's a big deal, to be honest with you. Herb, I really do.
Yeah, I agree. You know that there's only a relative few people that benefit from empire, and the rest of us suffer the consequences. We're vastly restricted in our range of action because of the greed and maliciousness of a few people.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think we have to start building enough love to break the shackles.
I'm with you. We have to do it together. That's why I support Bernie, because he is the one with the ad even that says we can do it together. And that's part of the idea of a government film agency. That's something we fund together with the idea of making lives better for more Americans. I mean, this is why, frankly, Herb, I was going to call you Chris, I'm so frustrated with the success of Clinton, because I just don't, she has not been ever somebody who brings people together. That just hasn't, even in foreign policy, she hasn't brought people together. She's made war. She's brought people together to kill each other.
Yeah, she's kind of got the divide and rule, slash and burn kind of warrior's mentality, and I don't think we've had far too much of that in this country's history, and I think it's really time to start turning the tide and go in for more peaceful and creative and healthy enterprises.
Good luck. I mean, I hope so, too. That's where I am, too. Hey, listen, Herb, let me let you go. I got a lot more to get to and not that much time. Thanks for the call. Appreciate Herb in Carmel. Appreciate it very, very much, that call. Okay, I told you I wanted to get to the comment from Jeff. What I had said on a show, I think it was on Friday, was that we should have a policy throughout the country where women, if they give birth, should be allowed to leave their baby, no questions asked, at the hospital and walk away. And I think there's a lot of reasons to do that. I just think that if somebody is overwhelmed with the idea of taking care of a child, isn't in a position to do so, we should not force people to be parents. We should not force people to be responsible for children. I think it's better for the children and it's better for the parent. I just believe that very strongly. And I also think that would be, for those of you who are opposed to abortions and don't want them, that would be another way to, I think, reduce the demand for abortions, as if a girl or woman knew that she could deliver the baby and then leave the baby at the hospital, she would maybe feel less pressure to have an abortion. And I'm not saying that women shouldn't have abortions. I say that women should do what they need to do, or girls should do what they need to do for themselves and their families. To decide what's in their best interest. But I also don't want to force anyone who's just given birth to have to take that responsibility on. Well, Jeff didn't like that idea at all. Jeff's comment was, do you think that's okay that people can walk away from their responsibility and burden others? And I find that such an interesting question, because it tells me exactly where Jeff is. Jeff is about punishing people. Jeff is about who's going to be responsible, who's going to have to pay. And that's not where I am. I'm about solving a problem. I'm about looking at a particular problem and saying, what's the best solution? So the problem is that a girl or woman had a baby that she's not capable, or doesn't believe she's capable of, or doesn't want to take care of. That's a problem for the mother. That's a problem for the baby. Obviously, it's an even bigger problem probably for the baby in the long run, because the baby's future is going to be formed in large part by its babyhood, by its childhood, by its infanthood, by its adolescence. And who one's parents are is enormously important during those formative years. Who's taking care of you? I do think that a woman who delivers a baby, or a girl who gives birth, shouldn't be allowed to walk away unless or until she at least identifies a father, because the father, you know, should also have to be given an option, given an opportunity. If the father may want to take care of the baby, if the father's in a position to take care of the baby, then the father should also be given that opportunity, afforded that opportunity. And if the woman or girl says she doesn't know, then you believe her, but maybe you ask a little bit, because again, I don't think if someone has a child, they shouldn't have an opportunity to take responsibility if they wish to. On the other hand, I would not hold the father financially responsible if the mother isn't going to keep the baby. So I think the best solution for everyone involved is when a woman or girl decides that she cannot care for her baby, she should be allowed to leave the baby at the hospital. I don't see why that's a tough one. If the father decides he wants to take responsibility, he can. And frankly, under those circumstances, probably the mother would have to be involved as well. and she would have to provide some support in some way, just as we require fathers to provide support. Now, there may be circumstances where you say, well, it was, you know, forced, it wasn't consensual sex, or it was incestuous, or something of that nature, and then maybe law enforcement gets involved. But the general idea that I have, and by the way, some states have this. There are states that have the safe harbor rule, which is the mom can leave the baby at the hospital and she's not responsible. And I do think that is the best solution. It's not that I'm saying you are excused from your responsibilities. It's not that I'm saying, okay, go ahead and burden society. I don't think it's such a burden. Infants are generally pretty adoptable. And if the baby is healthy, then the infant is adoptable. And if the baby isn't healthy because of the mother's irresponsibility, the father's irresponsibility, well, then society is going to be burdened no matter what. We're going to have to take care of that baby no matter what at some point. So I think you asked the wrong question, Jeff, when you say, do you think that's okay that people can walk away from the responsibility and burden others? Well, I don't think it's ideal, no. I don't think it's great that a new mother isn't in a position and doesn't want to take care of her child. I mean, that's not the ideal. But given that reality, then yes, the best solution for everyone involved, the child, the parent, and society, is to allow the mom, to give her that option. Yes, I don't think it's a hard one. I wonder why your first thought is of how this is going to be a burden and how this is going to be a responsibility instead of how do we address a problem that does come up. All right, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. Very quick break. I think I've got a new, actually it won't be that quick because it's the Scientific Americans are usually long, right? They aren't the 60-second science. Cutting carbon pollution could save healthcare. I think I played that before. Let me play the one I played earlier in the show. I'm really curious about this. Billion sun bright events leave radio wave clues.
This is Scientific American's 60-Second Science. I'm Lee Billings. Got a minute? Radio waves are invisible to our eyes. But if you could see them, the sky would dance with random tiny flashes. Thousands of what are called fast radio bursts are estimated to occur every day. And though each pinprick flash lasts only a thousandth of a second, they represent a faraway source briefly shining a billion or more times brighter than our sun. Fast radio bursts have been known for nearly a decade, but scientists have struggled to determine exactly where they come from, and they'd like to know. Because finding their origins would help astronomers use the bursts as probes to map the history and structure of the universe in unprecedented detail. Now, researchers have found the source of one particular burst. They used radio telescopes in Australia and the giant Subaru optical telescope in Hawaii to trace a burst observed last April. And they determined it came from an old elliptical galaxy full of exhausted, dying suns some 6 billion light-years away. The findings are in the journal Nature. Identifying the source galaxy provides crucial clues. For one thing, such a galaxy is short on some of the objects expected to cause bursts, such as supernovae or rapidly spinning and flaring pulsars, suggesting this burst came from something else. And although the burst in question lasted only milliseconds, astronomers were able to witness its faint, fading radio afterglow for about 6 days. That's the sort of afterglow expected from a colliding pair of ancient neutron stars, which would be a relatively common occurrence among an elliptical galaxy's geriatric suns. Even though this particular burst has probably been explained, many mysteries remain. Not all bursts seem to come from the same cosmic source. Fortunately, most possible burst sources could be distinguished by the gravitational waves they emit, like those recently seen by the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. That means researchers may soon be searching the skies for both radio and gravitational waves from these bursts to help draw an ever more detailed map of the cosmos. Thanks for the minute. For Scientific American's 60-Second Science, I'm Lee Billings.
All right, February 29th, 11:35 East Coast time. Dow up 61 points to 16,702. NASDAQ plus 22 to 4612. S&P 500 plus 7 to 1956. Gold's up 14 ounces to 1234. Oil is up 92 cents per barrel, currently priced at $33.67. Right, back on the Ginsberg Show, and I was playing from the Chris Rock monologue, and I see we've got another Chris. Chris calling back. Chris, I'll get to you in just a moment, but I played the song there. I was going to play a little more from Chris Rock as well, but I did want to respond to Carlos's question. I have said I think there should be a U.S. government film agency that's tasked with producing movies that star, are directed by, produced by, written by people who are normally not well represented in Hollywood. So people of color, poor people, immigrants, those would be the kind of people that I would think this government movie agency should be tasked with helping produce movies. That simple. From Carlos, huh? What hell? What would the product be? Why should the common moviegoer want to go to a government-funded movie? What would be the appeal? What would be acceptable movie plot? Saving Private Ryan, American Sniper, let's go further, Mandingo, Roots, 1984, Equilibrium. Are you suggesting documentaries? Who would control the content, Republicans or Democrats? Well, first of all, I guess the person who runs the agency could be a government appointee. Maybe there'll be a couple of government appointees, and then you just would have some bureaucrats underneath. But the basic, and we wouldn't need a whole bunch of people working there. Funds would be made available, certain number of funds available, as seed money for people who, again, are not well represented in Hollywood, in the jobs, in the star, as stars, as directors, behind the scenes, and plots that don't address aspects of American life, that do address aspects of American life that Hollywood hasn't done a good job of covering. I don't really think that's a very tough one. I don't know why this would be particularly controversial. I don't think Saving Private Ryan or American Sniper are particular plots that don't get a lot of that aren't really covered by Hollywood. I think if you want to do documentaries about what it's like to live on the south side of Chicago, if you want to do a movie about coal miners, yeah, that would be the kind of movie I'm thinking about. All right, let's go to Chris. I don't think it's a tough one. Chris in Seaside. Hey, Chris. Good morning. Again. By the way, Chris getting two bites at the apple, but I'm happy to give them to you. You called in with the Thought Wrestler, so I'm happy to have you back on. Good morning, Chris.
Yeah, hey, thanks a lot, Hal. I'm just going by your old rules that I kind of remember that said if you call in while you have a guest on to ask a question, that it would be also okay to call in.
The new rule has been one call per show, period. I relaxed it last week for Carl, sure. And I'm happy to do it again today. Now, again, if we get lots and lots of calls, it's a different sure. situation, and it's kind of as I make them up as I go along. But good morning. That said, good morning.
Drop me like a hot rock. I know the expression.
I will not drop you like a hot rock. What's up, my friend?
Hey, you were talking about the Academy Awards. I haven't seen too many movies this year. I saw this one called The Martian. That was real good. I think the best director who hasn't really got their due is Fia. You know, she's a Hollywood producer. She needs to be recognized. And one more thing, Hal. I don't know how many movies you saw this year, but what's your recommendation for a good
movie? I saw so few movies. We went to see Brooklyn the other week, and I enjoyed it, you know, but my wife liked it better. It was more like a kind of a tearjerker. It wasn't really a tearjerker. It was okay. I wasn't crazy about it. Brooklyn.
Brooklyn of old is from what I heard. You know, it was the old Brooklyn.
Yeah, it was from the 50s. It was kind of a period piece. It was about Irish immigrants, what their life was like in Brooklyn. I didn't love it. It was okay. My wife really liked it. Other people liked it. I want to see this movie Spotlight. But what do you think of my... Chris, hold on. Don't go anywhere. I got another caller. Just let me get this caller on for a sec. And I'll get you, caller, in just a sec. What do you think of my idea, though, of a government film agency, Chris, that's tasked with... I mean, because the concerns that I think are very, very legitimate that Chris Rock and that he kind of is having fun with, but is very deadly serious as well, but that the... Are you still with me? You're still with me. Will Smith's family, Will and his wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, they have a very legitimate beef. I mean, let's face it. These movies are not, they don't hire people. They don't employ people who are representative of our country. And they also don't show the whole range of Americans either. And I know you got on my case the other day for saying I'm against affirmative action. I just want to be clear. I haven't said I'm against it. I'm not necessarily in favor of it. But I would view this kind of a program that recognizes the importance of movies in American society, and that the movie should reflect. When you go to the movies, you should be able to see yourself or somebody like you who has a life similar to you. That life should be reflected on screen. And I think that if you want to call that affirmative action, I have no problem with it. I think we should have a government agency that says, listen, white people, especially white men, especially rich white men, don't have any trouble getting movies made about themselves or that represent an America that they want represented. Other people have more trouble. We're going to put a thumb on the scale to make sure we get movies made that depict other people.
Well, a lot of good points there, but I think Hollywood makes movies that will sell money. And movies that don't have that many African Americans in them seem to sell a lot more across the world. So your idea of having maybe an endowment for the arts, I don't know if that's what you're kind of leaning towards, would be good too.
Well, specifically, not just the arts, specifically for movies, but we should do, yeah, other countries do support their culture much better than we do with more money, but
no,
I'm just saying.
Listen, sometimes you're wrong, sometimes you're right. I think that's a pretty good idea. I haven't thought about it in detail, but anything that would represent all Americans is a great deal.
Look, if you're a poor American, period, you're probably not likely to see yourself on screen. If you're a poor African American, even less likely. A poor Latino immigrant, maybe even less likely than that. Remember there was a movie, what was the one about Beasts of the Southern Wild? That was just a revelation. That was a movie. Did you see that? It was about the folks.
But how don't people go to movies like to be entertained? I mean, I know my story as an African American needs to be portrayed to the world, but it can be
entertaining. Why can't your story be entertaining? Spike Lee made entertaining movies about
entertaining. According to Hollywood, it's put in a kind of a reconstructive mode of making fun of my culture, and I really don't want that. So I just go to the movies for entertainment. You know, it's sad that there are not a lot of African Americans in movies. And Chris Rock does have a great eye. He is correct that there are more important things. But in a lot of ways, what people see in the movies that are made in the United States around the world, that's what they think of the United States. And yes, you're correct. Sometimes those movies don't portray Jewish people correctly. They don't portray women.
I didn't say Jewish. There's plenty of Jewish people. We're not underrepresented. Woody Allen and all that, but no.
When I see a movie that has Jewish people in it, it's like a stereotype.
It's true. It's
Jewish
true.
Person.
You know what? You're
like
absolutely
that.
Right. You're absolutely right.
I don't like that. So
it's true.
It makes money. And that's true. The bottom line.
That is
money.
That you know what? You're
money
right. I shouldn't have dismissed that at all. You're absolutely right. Oftentimes, if they're religious, of any religion, there's a stereotype involved, Chris, and you do see that like sort of a sentimental Jewish person, like a Judd Hirsch character or someone like that. I think that is accurate. I think that's fair. You're saying that Hollywood makes movies to make money. I agree. But they also make movies to make a lot of money, big money everywhere. And okay. I don't disagree with you. I'm sure it's true that movies with all black cast or mostly African American stars or mostly stars of color maybe on average don't make as much money. But some of them do make money and they may make less, but you have a government film agency that's tasked with finding the most talented people from, you know, demographics that aren't well represented. I think those movies would make money. Maybe they wouldn't be Avatar money, but I mean, you know, they'd be Eve's Bayou money. If you ever saw, that's a great movie, Eve's Bayou, that was all, pretty much all African-American cast, and a great movie that nobody, very few people saw, but I'll bet it made some money. I'm going to look it up right now.
Well, you know, the fact that it makes money, that's the bottom line. We do live in a capitalistic society, and the fact that it makes money, sure. But so is making money more important than representing? You know, that's representing our culture. You know, that's the problem.
I guess I'm saying you can make good movies that star people who are of color, that are produced and directed by people of color, that are written by people of color, and they're good and they also make money. I don't think look, let me put down BET. A lot of crap on BET, right? This doesn't have to be BET. This could be really good stuff.
A lot of crap on BET. You know, I think we can make a great movie by if we just could get some Hollywood producers, Fia Kareem, to get all the callers and have a movie.
We would
have a very entertaining movie.
I appreciate that, Chris. Thanks for the call. Now I'm going to drop you. I'm going to drop you like a rock. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for the call, Chris. You know, actually, that idea of a movie with the callers, several people had suggested, or a TV show. And they used to, you know, they had that kind of stuff, like talk radio was a movie. And that was a grim movie, though. And there was news talk, I think, or news radio, and WKRP in Cincinnati. So lots of different options. Anyway, so I'm looking up Eve's Bayou, which was a very, very good movie. I think it was pretty much all black cast. I could be wrong. I'm looking at the stars. Samuel Jackson, Lynn Whitfield, Debbie Morgan. Jurnee Smollett, Megan Good, Diane Carroll. So that's pretty much all black cast. I don't know about the director. Kathy Lemons. So that movie, I don't know if they made money. It says the box office was $14.8 million. That's not terrible. I guess it's just a question of how much it cost to make it. I can't tell you whether it was profitable. But that's the kind of movie that you see very seldom, few and far between. And a very good movie and you know, very high quality, but very few and far between. So folks like who are in those movies, they're not getting enough work is the bottom line. So have them do more movies, and I'll bet you some of them will make money. I'm sure they will. Part of the dynamics in Hollywood are you want that. You know, everyone's going for a jackpot every time. You know, everyone wants that avatar. But it doesn't necessarily happen. And the little movies are sometimes, you know, where the aspirations are less, are often very successful. But even there, a lot of those art house movies are not, don't depict life the way so many Americans live it. And that would be the purpose of having the government film agency. All right, 844-4-HELG, 844-367-4254. Now, you know, I told you Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, the congresswoman, endorsed Bernie Sanders. So did Alan Grayson, the congressman with guts. And Robert Reich, I got his endorsement on Friday. He had not yet endorsed Bernie. Here's what he wrote. Dear fellow Move On member, I wasn't planning to endorse a presidential candidate in the Democratic primary. I have deep respect for both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and I play to weigh in only on issues and policies from the sidelines. But by last Friday, couldn't in good conscience hold back, so I formally endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. Now, that's really interesting, and I was happy to see it. I was not surprised. He explains that the reason he endorsed Bernie is because he believes big money is choking our democracy. It is perhaps the issue we must solve to move forward. Bernie's the one who will take on big moneyed interests, the ones who have rigged the game. So Reich endorsed Sanders. I found that particularly interesting because months ago I got into a Facebook fight with some Hillary Clinton supporters, and I quoted or cited an article by Robert Reich to justify my support for Bernie Sanders. And I was, you know, there was sort of like the online laughter, LOLROFLMAO, because these folks said, well, don't you know Reich is in Bernie's corner? Reich has endorsed Bernie, and he hadn't done that. He hadn't done that. Now he's done it. And you know what I say? Good. I say that if Robert Reich is on my side, then probably that's the right side to be on. If Robert Reich supports what I support, if he believes what I believe, in terms of candidates, then I'm feeling pretty good about where I am. Don't forget, you're listening to Hal Ginsberg, of course, but you're listening on Radio Monterey. This is the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show, and Radio Monterey broadcast shows for the open mind. I do encourage you to check our schedule, their schedule, at RadioMonterey.com. List of all the great shows from all the talented hosts, next up Tom Hartman. By the way, again, last show in February, Black History Month, and I want to see if I can get just a little more from Chris Rock, and he gives us a little history lesson here, and then I want to play, if I can, the New York Times pretty scathing indictment, if I have to end that way, I will, Hillary Clinton and her decision making as Secretary of State with respect to Libya.
We have real things to protest. You know, it's too busy being raped and lynched to care about who won best cinematographer. You know, when your grandmother's swinging from a tree, it's really hard to care about best documentary foreign short.
It's really, I don't know where you go. I mean, I give a 10 to Chris Rock for that. Is he making light of the crimes, the horrors of Jim Crow? I don't think so. I don't think he's making light of it. I think he's bringing home to people, this is our history. This is our shared history. And, you know, let's not become too self-important and think what we do is somehow more important or is that important that compared to lynching, Jim Crow laws, being treated as a second-class citizen. That's what's important. And I think Rock deserves credit for bringing that up. And especially, you know, again, on the 28th day of February. So thank you, Chris Rock. Doing a really good job at the Oscars. It's disappointing to me that the ratings were apparently down. I think it was more the movies. I don't think it was because of Chris Rock. I mean, he's hosted before. I don't know what his numbers have been like. But I thought that was pretty powerful stuff. And he opened up. And it was right that he brought this up right out of the bat. Because obviously, this is what's on people's minds in this election year, in this very stressful year, in this year where there's a lot of tension. All right, 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254. I did want to play this for you, Hillary Clinton's legacy in Libya. With tomorrow being Super Tuesday, some of you may not, if you're voting, you know, tomorrow, you may vote before you even hear me. So I do want to leave you with this thought if you're going to vote in the Democratic primary in your state tomorrow.
Hillary Clinton's role in the military intervention that ousted Muammar Gaddafi in Libya is getting new scrutiny as she runs for president. The U.S. relationship with Libya has long been complicated. Colonel Gaddafi, who ruled from 1969 until 2011, was an eccentric dictator linked to terrorism. Still, when he gave up his nuclear program a decade ago and provided information about Al-Qaeda, he became an ally of sorts. In 2009, when Mrs. Clinton was Secretary of State, she welcomed one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons to Washington.
Deeply valued the relationship between the United States and Libya.
But 2 years later, when Colonel Gaddafi threatened to crush the Arab Spring protests in Libya, she helped persuade President Obama to join other countries in bombing his forces to prevent a feared massacre.
This operation has already saved many lives, but the danger is far from over.
The military campaign ended up ousting Colonel Gaddafi, and Secretary Clinton was welcomed to Libya on a victory tour. A few days later, Colonel Gaddafi was killed by opposition fighters.
We came, we saw, he died.
But the new Western-backed government proved incapable of uniting Libya. And in the end, the strong man's death led to chaos. When four Americans were killed by terrorists in Benghazi in 2012, it revealed just how bad things had gotten. Colonel Gaddafi's huge arsenal of weapons has shown up in the hands of terrorists in places like Gaza, Syria, Nigeria, and Mali. Hundreds of thousands of migrants have fled through Libya on boats. Many have drowned. And the power vacuum has allowed ISIS to build its most dangerous outpost on the Libyan coast. Today, just 300 miles from Europe, Libya is a failed state. Meanwhile, back at home, Mrs. Clinton has struggled to defend the decision to intervene.
But I'm not giving up on Libya, and I don't think anybody should. We've been at this
but were mistakes made?
Well, there's always a retrospective to say what mistakes were made, but I know that we offered a lot of help, and I know it was difficult for the Libyans to accept help.
Just really, what an indictment of her supposed, her success, her experience as Secretary of State. And it's just hard to think of anything that turned out worse than her decision, her, you know, commitment to persuading President Obama not just to stop Gaddafi from invading East Libya and taking back areas that rebels had controlled, but to just keep bombing and bombing and bombing. What a complete and utter foreign policy disaster. And I thank you so much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow, Tuesday, the beginning of Super Tuesday. 844-4LG, call then, 844-367-4254. Ocean breezes touched my face, and as I got close to Monterey Bay, I could feel my soul embrace. The rhythm of the waves, soaring seagulls.